It's time for TWiT this week in tech. Man, we got a great show for you. Jason Heiner from Tech Republic is here. Brian McCullough from Tech Memes Ride Home. And the wild man himself, Greg Farrow from the Packet Pushers Network. We're going to talk about predictions for 2019, foldable phones, the advent of gene editing. I mean, it is just a crazy, crazy show. Stand by. TWiT is next.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is TWiT, This Week in Tech, episode 703, recorded Sunday, January 27th, 2019. Algorithms are people, too. This Week in Tech is brought to you by Casper, a sleep brand that continues to revolutionize its line of products to create an exceptionally comfortable sleep experience, one night at a time. Get $50 towards select mattresses by visiting casper.com/TWiT and using the promo code TWiT at checkout. And by Cashfly. Give your users the seamless experience online that they want. Power your site or app with Cashfly CDN and be 30% faster than the competition. Learn more at twit.cashfly.com. And by Eero. Never think about Wi-Fi again when you can have brilliant, hyper-fast, super-simple Wi-Fi with Eero. And now, get total network protection with Eero Plus. Visit Eero.com/twit and get $100 off the Eero base unit, 2 beacons package, and 1 year of Eero Plus when you enter the code TWIT at checkout. And by Wasabi Hot Cloud Storage. From the founders of Carbonite comes the cloud storage technology that's disrupting the industry. See for yourself with free unlimited storage for a month. Go to wasabi.com, click free trial, and use the offer code TWIT. It's time for TWIT This Week in Tech, the show where we cover the week's tech news. Each week we assemble. This is the one show we do where it's a different panel every week. But I like the variety. And what's good is we always bring back the people we like the most, and we've got some of them on right now, including the fabulous Greg Farrow from the Packet Pushers Network. Hello, Greg!
How's it going, everybody?
Ethereal mind on the Twitter and in our chat room today.
Thank
good
you.
Good to see you. You're in you're in Oxford?
I'm in the middle of England in a town called Cheltenham.
Cheltenham,
which is
that's
just
right.
Just next to Gloucester.
Lovely.
Which nobody knows where either of those is, so I don't even know why I said that.
It's Cheltenham. It's right next to Gloucester.
It's where the GCHQ is.
Yeah, we're just in Petaluma. That's right next to Cotati.
Yeah. Just up the road from San Francisco. You know?
That's what I usually say. In fact, when we're traveling and people say where we're from, we almost always just say San Francisco or the Bay Area.
Yeah.
Nobody knows Petaluma. Jason Heiner, he's from a little town called Louisville, Kentucky. Hello, Jason.
That's right.
Editor-in-chief of the Tech Republic. Always a pleasure.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me. It's always fun.
Lisa and I have been watching a great documentary called 7 Days. The premise is the 7 days before a big event, and they did the Kentucky Derby, and we both said, we got to call Jason. Got to go to Louisville for the Kentucky Derby. I would love to do that. You go every year,
amazing.
Right?
I don't go every year, but obviously I have been. During the dot-com boom, Tech Republic had one of the biggest booths on Millionaire's Row when money was cheap in the dot-com era.
You mean you don't anymore?
No, we haven't for years. I mean, now we might get one of those little, you know, scroungy boxes or something. You know,
times have changed.
times have changed big time. And
I remember,
also, there's so many more people that want to be at the Kentucky Derby now, right? Like it's everybody wants to be there. So you're competing with Tom Brady and with everybody else, Michael Jordan, all these people. You know, they're buying out the big expensive boxes.
Yeah, it's harder to get there. It's become famous. This is the way of the world, unfortunately. By the time I find out about it, it's too late. Anyway, great to have you, Jason, CBS Interactive. And all the way to my left, Brian McCullough. He is the host of the Tech Meme Ride Home podcast and an internet historian. Your book is great, by the way.
Thank you, sir.
How's it doing?
Quite well. And actually, it's funny. I was going to hit some history. The only thing I know about Gloucester is Richard III, right?
My horse, a horse, my kingdom for the horse, right, Greg? He doesn't know.
I don't know.
All right.
Anyway, the only thing I think I know about Gloucester
is
remember that.
Yeah.
I don't know. There's so much history around here where we live. This is the Midlands, and it's, you know, cathedrals and castles and all that sort of stuff that it just becomes every day, and you kind of stop absorbing the facts. I know that's kind of weird for people who are watching, but that's a realist.
I wouldn't stop. I'd be hitting you with annoying facts every 5 seconds.
were you, Brian? I know you're an internet historian, but were you a history major, a history buff?
I was actually a film major.
Oh, no kidding.
No, yeah, but all I ever read are history. There's a great book I'm reading right now called Horse Wheel something about the history of the Indo-European language and how it's the root language of most of all Western languages.
Nice. Brian was on our triangulation show in November talking about how the internet happened from Netscape to the iPhone. Brand new. Get yourself a copy.
Writing history like that is easy if you lived through it.
Oh, and as long as we're plugging books, thank you, Karsten Bondi. Follow the Geeks, 10 Digital Innovators in the Future of Work. That's Jason Heiner's great book.
Thank you.
I am chapter 9.
Chapter 9. You're also the sample chapter on Audible.
Yay.
When you go to Audible and you hit sample chapter, you get the intro to Leo's chapter. Yes. A scene from Leo in the desert, realizing that there were hundreds of people coming to see him.
Yeah, Las Vegas.
Had no idea what the heck was going on.
Wild, huh?
Yeah.
Well, let's see. I don't know where to begin. There's so many stories this week. I might start with this. This is Scott Galloway, who wrote another book that we've talked about, The Big Four, all about the four horsemen of the tech apocalypse. He has his predictions for 2019 for big tech and beyond. He did something very brave. He went back and looked at his predictions last year and graded them. That's what you do if you're a professor.
That is brave.
Very brave. He thought Wayfair would crash. He was wrong. He thought Twitter, Snap, and BuzzFeed would be acquired. He was wrong. But he did a few things right. He said Amazon would surpass Apple in value. No one would have thought that. And that was partly because of a stock market bust as opposed to the growth of Amazon. But maybe Amazon was...
His point with the Amazon was that it's got much greater growth potential than Apple does, because Apple has to top out when there's a phone in every pocket. And they don't have a successor to that, whereas Amazon has plenty of room to grow in e-commerce. Like in the U.S., Amazon's only reaching like 5% of the total retail market. And they might have 50% of online business, but that's still only 5% of the overall retail turnover in the US. So they've got so much more room to grow. There's no way they're not going to be bigger than Apple eventually.
But that's not the reason why Amazon stock doubled last year. It's because of AWS, they stumbled onto a second horse.
Completely accidentally, right?
Yeah.
Hey, we've got some extra servers in the closet, Jeff. What should we do with those?
Yeah. The second horse is going to be way bigger than the e-commerce business.
Way bigger.
Well, and then also, everyone's always talking about how they're getting into advertising and things like that. But like, if you think about it, like, obviously, I'm not saying anything anybody doesn't know, but Amazon has their fingers in so many pies that, like, so, you know, everybody's doing a streaming thing. Amazon's had streaming video for forever. But, you know, the insane advertising thing that they could do is if they release an ad-supported – I think they already do through Twitch or something, an ad-supported streaming video play. Well, the ads could be tailored to things that you've already bought in your Amazon history, to things that you've looked at but haven't bought yet. So, like, they could potentially they have so many potential huge things they can tap.
Actually, to that point – Scott, and again, this is talking about last year's predictions. He said Amazon Media Group would surpass the revenue of Twitter and Oath. What he didn't predict is that Oath would be renamed Verizon Media Group. But he was but he was right about revenue. He says at the beginning of the year, Morgan Stanley predicted Amazon's media group would have a revenue of $4.5 billion. It probably is closer to $11 billion. Even media is doing well for Amazon. Let's look at his predictions, though, for 2019. Snap is The Walking Dead. I think that's pretty obvious, or no? Think Snapchat will survive?
I think Snap was The Walking Dead, but if Facebook merges, and this is another news article which maybe we'll cover, but they had an article in New York Times. New York Times got a scoop on Facebook saying that Facebook wants to merge Instagram, WhatsApp, and the Facebook Messenger program into one. If that happens, then Snapchat will be very popular because Facebook will screw that up and drive customers into the arms of Snapchat.
Very interesting. Yeah, because Facebook is notorious for screwing stuff like that up.
As soon as Zuckerberg gets involved in something, it gets screwed up. Yeah.
Yeah, the theory
Google will buy Twitter and Snap.
I've been saying that for the last 5 years.
No,
You think so?
They've just been waiting for Twitter to get cheap enough to buy. Yeah. I think I said once Twitter's at 12, they're not even close to 12 right now. It's gone way up. But once it gets to 12, I think Google pulls the trigger.
Galloway predicts Twitter will be cut in half in 2019, mostly because of bots, foreign agents, all of the crap on Twitter. I think that's a fair prediction, but I've been saying that for years too. So I don't know.
Doesn't do content. It doesn't. Google can't be a media company, and Twitter, Facebook, Snap—they're all media companies. So right. Google can't buy them and won't.
Twitter really isn't a media company, though. They are trying to be, but they're really a data company. They just don't know it yet. And so
doesn't matter. Google's getting nailed in the EU for antitrust, for screwing over the local press, for all that stuff, right? And if they were to buy Twitter, the European Union would be down on them so hard that it wouldn't matter. Twitter, Snap, Facebook, they're publishers. They're absolutely content creators. Their platforms are all about stealing content from other people and publishing it, as repackaging it as content that they produce. Google can't do that. And if it does, it will die. It will instantly be subject to an antitrust action in the EU and then shortly after that in the
US. Ultimately, though, they're all in the same business, which is collecting data for sales, right? I mean, that's really the business. It's just a matter of how you get that data.
That's the business. Twitter, I do think Twitter is a real-time data business. I do agree with you, Greg, though, in that most people don't understand that. I think Twitter barely understands it.
That's the problem, frankly. Twitter's got the worst management ever. They don't seem to understand what to do with it, right? Or is it just hard?
Did you read the article from Jack Dorsey that he published this week?
Yeah, Jack.
And he was, the guy is insane. The guy's a nutcase. He's going on about, we've got to do this. And, I met Mark Zuckerberg and we killed a goat and then we ate it and, blah, blah, blah. And you go like, this is not how the CEO of a major media a major company acts. Like, we've seen Elon Musk come unhinged. Now we're watching Jack Dorsey turn into a Fruit Loop. Zuckerberg's clearly losing his control over at Facebook. He's just like, I don't know what to do. I'm going to just say stuff and see what happens. And it's all just going bananas, right? It's really funny watching these tech company CEOs all just blow up because they don't know what it's like to have a bad day.
I mean, the world is changing around them so quickly. Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, go ahead.
Oh, you guys are too polite. Just jump in. Go ahead, Jason.
If you're Elon Musk, if you're Mark Zuckerberg, if you're Jack Dorsey, the world is changing around them so quickly. And their companies, when they get big, it's just hard to change big companies quickly. And they are struggling really, really hard with it. Everything great has been created by small teams and usually gets eventually screwed up by big teams. And even the iPhone, I'm sure you guys have seen the stories and I've talked to people that were on the original team, the iPhone team. It was about 20 people that made the iPhone. You get in the position where when it's big enough, you play not to lose. And that's what we're seeing now is they're playing not to lose. It doesn't work at internet scale. It doesn't work at internet speed. And these are problems that are a little unique to the history of business. And it's not going well.
Not?
I mean, I will completely agree.
That's complete bunk. Stop apologizing for them. Those people are all idiots. They were kids.
I'll say this. Yeah. I think it's pretty clear Mark Zuckerberg was just incredibly lucky.
Yeah.
Right?
He's not smart.
Yes. Agreed.
He's
incredibly
not
lucky. Jack Dorsey, who knows why Jack Dorsey is running Twitter? Mostly because Ev and company just said, screw it. I got enough money. And then Google, Larry and Sergey, incredibly lucky, for a long time didn't even know what they had. Some adult supervision came along, probably Eric Schmidt, but somebody came along and said, dudes, you got this mountain of data. This is really valuable stuff. And they went, what?
Yeah,
and
this is a data business.
That's, again, I think lucky, and I don't know who you'd point to be the genius there. Actually, I have a theory, but I don't want to get too much in the weeds on that one. In most cases, these guys are like Mark Cuban. They just are lucky sons of guns. They got in the right place at the right time, and they cashed in.
Mark Cuban was smart enough to cash in and get out and be a billionaire professionally.
Yeah, that's right. His life is a lot easier, right? Because he didn't have this delusion that he was a genius.
I've said that many times, that Mark Cuban is quietly the most brilliant man ever to be in the tech industry because he got out. But the thing with
– By the way, if I'd gotten – somebody bought Twit from me, like Yahoo bought Broadcast.com from – and I got $1 billion, I would have gotten out too. So just give me some – I would have been just as brilliant.
So the thing with Jack is – and that article, because Jack's on a publicity tour again. And this happened the same – I was on – the last time I think it was, I was on the show. There was the Zuckerberg piece that got all the controversy. Like, you know, I know PR people think that this is a good idea. We need to get him out there. He was on the Bill Simmons podcast. I'm a human like you, fellow humans.
Yeah.
The problem with
Jack. that's Mark does that too. I am a human like you, fellow.
Exactly. Yes. And so Jack's flavor of that is that he
I killed a goat.
Because actually he was trying to differentiate himself.
He said he had a salad when
right.
Mark had the goat.
Thought that was a little weird. But that's the thing. So Jack, he sometimes comes off as like almost the most zen and like evolved tech CEO out there. But then other times, and most times, it's like, well, or he's just a flake. And so, like, you know, when he – I think there was a tweet this weekend about him talking about his three-day fasts and things like that. And I can't remember because I'd give her a quote, obviously. But as somebody on Twitter said, well, now I understand why Twitter is the way it is, because – the CEO is starving all the time. And when you talk to people that work at Twitter, the thing that they always say is when they go to other companies, they can't believe that decisions actually get made in a logical, timely manner. Because at Twitter, the culture is just like, you know, it takes them 3 years to decide to go beyond the character limit on tweets. And it's just like you can be zen and you can be philosophical, but also you need to be decisive.
I don't want to imply that these people are flawed. I'm not saying that. I'm saying they're normal. And that, unfortunately, they got very lucky. And what happens when you become a billionaire is you think that you suddenly your mind gets twisted and you think you did it and you are somehow godlike. And the problem is that the problems that these companies face are very difficult. Normal. Yep. It's not an easy thing to do. I mean, we can see this is the history of technology companies from day one. The one person that I think might be a god, I'm not sure, is Jeff Bezos.
For sure.
Mostly Jeff Bezos hired people under him. So he set up a process so that the way that Amazon works is he created a management structure.
Yeah, but that was smart.
Mostly him.
But that was smart, right? I mean, the whole pizza principle of don't have a meeting that you can't have more feed with two pizzas. The whole idea of writing instead of making pitches for stuff, writing the press release. I think he did some very, very smart things.
That was a good one. The second one was he swindled the investors into convincing them not to take a profit.
So that only worked for a little while, though. Remember, he could no longer go back to the capital markets around about 2000, and he had to start to turn that profit knob a little bit.
Those are the two innovations. Now, the challenge is I would never work for Amazon because those people are used like slaves.
That's another bright thing that Jeff Bezos did.
They're known for working them to the bone.
You want to become the richest man in the world?
Extort it from the slaves.
How else?
I mean, the workers.
How else? You don't build the pyramids with the, you know, 9-to-5 workers.
Let's ask the history guy about this.
Well, I was gonna use the pyramids analogy or whatever, but okay. So to bring it full circle, though, and to say that Bezos is probably the closest to genius, is so that even if he doesn't come up with AWS himself, like we're saying, he put up you know, look at what Google's been trying to do moonshots for how long now. They know they're a one-trick advertising pony. They know that's not really changing the world.
And they can't do it.
And the same thing when you see Facebook trying to get into hardware, and you see, you know, even
Twitter doesn't even try.
Apple's
to like, what's next? No idea.
Okay. So Amazon has in place a system that, hey, you know, Jeff, this thing over here, you know, we've got these spare computer cycles and things like that. Do you think there's a business here? And there's a mechanism in place for them to go explore it. And then when it works, to then actually execute, that's actually the key. Anyone can come up with great other business ideas, but then to execute on turning that into your next great business, and, that's insane.
Yes.
I'm going to give credit, by the way.
Paying taxes, he was able to use that to fund those things. So literally what he did was, instead of paying shareholders a dividend, he would punt on all these startups. You know?
Yeah, but what did he do that was genius? He got these investors, got them to give him millions of dollars, plowed every penny of profit into what? Distribution centers.
Growth.
Yeah. And that was the right move.
Yeah, not just
a gutsy move, right?
Well, yes and no. There's two things they do. One is as we've already pointed out, is they continue to innovate and develop new business ideas. So they built distribution centers because the freight companies couldn't do it for them, or the handling companies couldn't do it for them, and getting the goods closer to the customer, blah, blah, blah. And now they're buying planes. And now they've looked at using drones to do home deliveries. Now they're doing robot carts to do deliveries.
With all of those warehouses and with all that distribution, they did the genius thing of allowing third parties onto that platform, since, hey, we already have this here anyway.
Right.
There is more money made by Amazon from the third parties that are on the Amazon platform than Amazon. It's not even close this day and age,
but that's,
that Amazon sells itself.
Exactly. But the secret to that platform is that the people using the platform must get more profit than you get from it yourself.
That's okay.
And that is where YouTube has failed.
The whole key. He comes from hedge funds, right? He understands that the key is to collect all the crumbs. It's fine if other people make money. As long as you get a percentage of every financial transaction, you're going to be the wealthiest man in the world.
The difference 15%. Between Amazon and everybody else is they know what business they're in, right? We're talking about the problems with all these other companies. They don't really know what business they're in.
This is funny. It's a bunch of poor podcasters talking about how to become rich. There's a certain irony in all of this.
Here's the secret. We know we don't want to be them, right? I look at all those CEOs like Zuckerberg, founder CEOs particularly, Musk, Zuckerberg, Dorsey and
was
and
Musk
all that
lucky? Stuff. I feel like Musk was pretty smart.
Yeah, but at some point you've got to
stand for his original businesses. He's pretty lucky.
I think
he's
a visionary. Yeah, PayPal. I think he's a visionary.
You can be a visionary, but at some point you have to stand back and let someone execute. So when we look at
he has not been good at that.
You look at more traditional companies, there are people running them at the top who are grown-ups that don't say things. So you look at Michael Dell, for example, still at the helm of Dell, but you don't see him going off for 3-day meditation temple, you know, in a country which is
If he wants to go to Myanmar and sit in a cave, that's fine.
Yeah, that's fine, but don't talk about it, right?
Yeah, don't tell anybody. If you do that,
I don't want to know.
That's the British in you, right there.
It is. That's very British. It's all right. It's so just don't tell anybody.
It's so egotistical to tell people about your personal life and put it
Welcome
out there in
to America.
It's like, who cares about you?
So I just want to, as a complete footnote, I do want to say that I think that the evil genius at Google was not Sergey, it was not Larry. It was not Eric Schmidt. It was this guy who probably most people don't know is Hal Varian. He is to this day the chief economist at Google. Mm. He wrote the seminal papers at the end of the last century that said, here's where we have value. Here's how we can capitalize on this value. And if you want to know more about why Google took that pivot, because it's interesting. I interviewed Shoshana Zuboff about her book, Surveillance Capitalism. In the book, she quotes Larry giving a speech in 1998 about Google, saying we could never take advertising because that would taint the search product. We have to stay above that. That was Larry and Sergey did not.
That's in their original paper.
That's in the paper.
Their PhDs for.
It was Hal Varian who came along and said, look, first of all, there's been a stock market crash. We better find a way to make money fast because the investors are getting itchy. And here's how we do it. So maybe Hal Varian deserves credit, not well known. And that's where, Greg, you're right. Just keep your, hide your light under a bushel.
Yeah. Yeah. If you're well, the leader of that sort of company, we expect you to be a grown up and say things that people expect you to say, be reasonably well behaved in public. And if you want to go and have a bunch of mistresses and do BDSM in your own time, don't go and make sure that comes out in public. Just don't do that, right? Yeah, yeah. Just keep it in your pants.
Well,
more thing about Amazon. Sorry, last thing on Amazon. Just, you know, knowing what business they're in, you know, they figured out, over the last, especially 5 years, that their business of the future is delivering things to people, delivering goods and delivering bits, right? Even just electronic stuff, and making micro transactions off of every single one of them, right? And so that is why the future, they are already, owning more and more of the future and where it's headed. And the thing that could hold them back is if, they're going to run into some of these same problems that some of the other companies are, but they know what business they're in and they know, use that to make the decisions. I think a lot of these other companies, Twitter, Facebook, to an extent, Google still sometimes is reaching and trying to figure things out, is that, they're still not quite sure what the future, could be, or how big they could get, or what are the most important aspects of what they do for their customers. So that's
most companies, though, never have a second act, right?
Yeah.
It's really true. That's a hard thing to do.
Well, not only do they not have a second act, 50% of acquisitions they make fail.
Yeah.
Statistically, right?
Yeah.
And for some companies,
and they do those acquisitions because they're trying to find a second act, but often that's a failure too. Interestingly, the Galloway's predictions, a lot of them have to do with Amazon. He says Amazon will become one of the five largest media firms by the end of 2020. He says Amazon, this is an interesting prediction, will spin off AWS to reduce antitrust concerns. Is it inevitable?
Yeah. Yeah.
It has to be.
He also says Amazon.
That's been talked about for some time. That's been moot by most people.
Begins their march toward becoming the most valuable healthcare company in the world.
I talked to Christina Farr last week, and not only that, they're about to get into health insurance, not just with the combination with Berkshire Hathaway and whoever the other third
party. JP Morgan,
It's going to be health insurance this year, she thinks.
The spinoff thing is not right, though. The spinoff thing, if you look at their actual earnings, their business, AWS is their business. Like, it is the only really profit engine.
Jeff gets to keep the stock.
Business.
It's not it's absolutely going to happen. The simple fact is, AWS is still only earning about $6 to $8 billion a quarter. So it's still tiny, but it's got massive growth potential. So, for example, Cisco makes $12 to $13 billion a quarter, and AWS is only half the size of Cisco. HPE does $8 billion a quarter, and AWS is tiny. But AWS has mammoth growth potential, and it's actually driving change in the market. So if they float that off, it could be as much as 60% of the value of Amazon today. And so you're going to get that cash, and then you can put it back into AWS, and he can make AWS blow up like a nuclear bomb. It's like becoming critical mass.
Nah, I think that it's the only good business they have. These other businesses are so dependent on so many different things: fuel, margin. The margins are terrible. AWS is the only really great business they have. I think it's more likely they spin off the e-commerce business into something that low margin business. But the future of that business is delivering electronic goods, and all of it is through AWS.
No. You can't disassemble the platform. You can't disassemble the shopping platform and the app or the ad network.
There is a synergy. There is a synergy.
There is a synergy, but the real
qualm, and in fact, we're going to get to this after the break, is regulation. And everybody, I think, in Silicon Valley is terrified. That was the point of Scott Galloway's book, was here comes the government. His last prediction, I think a little tongue-in-cheek, Sheryl Sandberg will marry Mackenzie Bezos. They'll pool their $70 billion fortune and become the largest shareholders in Alphabet. Ms. Sandberg reanimates Google Plus. Ms. Bezos takes over Google's voice group, and they legally adopt Evan Spiegel. I hope that happens. He is
a funny guy, but he makes a very good point about Sheryl Sandberg, and he says that unfortunately, because she's a woman,
he says she's going to leave.
Well, she has to at this point. She has to be the shield that somebody has to take the fall, right? And
for
the
George Soros stuff, for all of that, she's going to take the fall for that. Yeah.
For so absolutely. they need to make a show of we're getting new blood in here. We're doing generational turnover. Yeah.
By the way, there is a connection. Sheryl Sandberg learned about Google and the way they use data when she worked at Google, and she brought it to Facebook. She brought the flame from Hal Varian and carried the flame across the street to Facebook and said, "Look." Fire.
It's fire. It's
fire.
So I do think it'll be, she's likely to leave for whatever reason, however they frame it.
Wow. Well, let's take a break because I want to talk about Mark Zuckerberg's Wall Street Journal editorial. There's a lot more to talk about. As you could see, a fiery panel today. And it's usually when Greg Farrow's here. He fires them up. Greg Farrow from the Packet Pushers Network. Jason Heiner from CBS Interactive. Tech Republic. He's EIC there. And Brian McCullough. Tech Memes Ride Home Podcast, Internet Historian. And our show today brought to you by, we're talking about mattresses, Casper. Casper. We love our Casper. Casper is an online premium mattress retailer. They invented this whole idea of, well, you know, this is where Silicon Valley really is good. They look for inefficiencies in markets. And the guys who founded Casper said, look, this is crazy. A company makes a mattress, then they sell it through a showroom that marks it up 100% or more to an end user. This is crazy. We could sell direct and cut out the middleman and sell great mattresses for much less money. But then, good thinkers that they are, they said, well, there's one little problem with that. People want to go to a showroom and lie on a mattress. Not that that's a good way to test a mattress. I could tell you, I've many a mattress I've gone to the showroom, lain on it, lied on it. And what is it, Carson? You went to Harvard.
You laid on it.
I laid on it. Chickens lay an egg, but people lie on mattresses. Anyway, whatever it is, I've gotten the wrong mattress more than once by doing that. So what Casper said is, we're going to give you 100 days, or maybe it's better to say 100 nights with this mattress. At any time in the first 100 days, if it's not perfect, we will come and get it. We will take it away. We'll refund you every penny. That solved the problem. The original Casper mattress combines multiple supportive memory foams for a sleep surface with just the right sink, but also bounce. It's hard to describe. That's why you have to lie on it or lay on it or do whatever you do with it. Actually, I do both because you want it to, you want it, it's gives to your knobbly parts. But it's firmly supporting your back. Is that a way to describe it? I don't know. You have to try it. And I really have to say this is true. It's breathable, which means you sleep cool. And we know from sleep experts, sleeping cool is the key to a great night's sleep. You're going to get long-lasting support, long-lasting comfort from your mattress. You buy it completely risk-free online. Here's our Casper. This is our second Casper. We love it. It is an incredible mattress. They uphold the highest environmental production standards. They're made in the USA. They come in a surprisingly compact box, which is really great. We got one for my son's dorm room because he didn't like the mattress that was in the dorm for obvious reasons. So he was able to schlep it upstairs. It's great. And it was so affordable. After 4 years, we said, you can leave it there. We'll give you a new one when you get your apartment. Casper. Good. Doesn't that make you want to just... Get a Casper mattress today. You can save $50 towards select mattresses when you go to Casper, CASPER.com/twit, and use the promo code TWIT at checkout. Casper.com/twit, promo code TWIT to save $50 on select mattresses. Terms and conditions apply. Thank you, Casper. If I am well rested, you can thank Casper. Now I'm relaxed. Greg will fire me up.
So I do have one topic I want to raise reasonably early, if I may.
This DNS thing, right?
Yeah, DNS Flag Day. So let me try and preface this. This is going to get a little bit nerdy, so strap yourself in. I'll try and keep it short for the people who aren't related to that. So this is the Internet Society. That is the body that is responsible for parts of the Internet. Are making a fairly substantial change to the way that DNS works. So
what's wrong with DNS?
There's nothing wrong with DNS. Over the years, we've changed the standards from DNS to a thing called enhanced DNS or eDNS. The standard was done 7493, I think, from memory. It was done like 10 years ago. And what they did was the idea, the original DNS had a maximum query size of 512 bytes in the packet. And that was no longer big enough. When we went to Unicode, the data that was being jammed into the packet oversized the packet. So we created a thing called enhanced DNS or extended DNS, and that allowed for a larger packet size. Now, that was fine, but all of the DNS servers on the internet, if you got a query from somebody who was using legacy DNS, they would tolerate your non-eDNS query and respond back to you and say, okay, we'll give you some time to do the transition.
Let me talk down to you because you have a server that's stupid.
Yeah, you know, V1, kind of like V1, V2.
Aren't there a lot of people not using eDNS now?
It's a very small number. It's like 2 to 5%. And they've sort of got to the point saying, look, we can't move the DNS infrastructure on. We need to make changes to DNS, like DNS over HTTPS. We need to make changes to the increase the security, but we can't unless everybody's at least gotten away from the technology from 30 years ago. So they've put a flag down and said on the 1st of February is DNS flag day. We're going to start the new version of Bind, which is what most people use, will no longer support DNS only. If you make a query and you don't flag that I do not, so you've got to be able to support at least enough of the extensions to say, I don't understand eDNS, give me a DNS response. If you make an invalid or a legacy query, these servers will no longer respond. And it's going to be a bit like a rot, you know, like a link rot thing we used to have years ago. They used to worry about what happens when all of these shorteners used to disappear and then all these links would be dead. Some people are going to not be able to access some things. So if you own a domain, get out there, start running a test. Go to dnsflagday.com and put your domain in and find out if it's going to pass the tests. And you don't have to rush it. You know, it's not an apocalyptic thing. It's just something that's going to start having an impact as some users won't be able to work. And it's mostly going to be companies who implement firewall appliances, because a lot of the firewalls have these proxies and the DNS queries come in and then they go out. And if those haven't been kept up to date, there's a fair bet that they're where the problem is.
It's dnsflagday.net, by the way, not .com.
Oh, sorry.
.net.
My apologies.
So, so this doesn't affect home users, end users at all. But if you have, like we have, twit.tv, if you have a domain, you should make sure that it works.
Yes.
And it does. I'm okay. Mm-hmm. All right.
Mine don't. So I'm having a problem with hover.com. They're
really?
Not updating. Yeah. If you test gregferro.com, which is my personal blog site, all my others are hosted at Cloudflare. But yeah, hover.com.
I do everything at Hover. I'm going to try
Leo. They're not compliant and they will be.
So this is like yours. This is at Hover, leolaporte.com. So this, to be clear, it's hosted at WordPress.com, but the DNS goes through Hover.
That's right. Yeah. Now, it's going to work because they do just support the eDNS query and respond with legacy DNS answers, right? So they're not broken. As it says there, you're going to work. But I contacted Hover, and they said, we're not going to fix it.
What?
And if you don't like it, leave.
Why not?
Hey, I don't know. I believe that Hover might be in a rent extraction mode. So the original company that it was a couple of years ago, which was really innovative and really doing good things, it would seem that whoever's running the business now just wants to haul all the profit they can out of it and do nothing. So,
oh, dear, because all of our...
Screw them.
They were. I don't know if they're still a sponsor. I think they might be, but regardless, all of our domains are through Hover. I thought twit.tv is as well, I believe.
Yeah. Just because if you're using them as a registrar, but you've got your DNS somewhere else.
We have the DNS somewhere else.
Yes, yeah. I have all of my domains registered at most of my domains at Hover, but my DNS is most often hosted at Cloudflare. So I'll start migrating my domains away to Cloudflare in the next few weeks.
Wow.
Just because their response was so bad. It was basically like, so what? We're not fixing it. And if you don't like it, go. Literally, I can send you a screenshot. It's pretty amazing.
Wow. Well, that's a good takeaway. You know, if you got your domains there, you know, seriously think about moving them.
Well, Hover is still a sponsor, so I'm going to. I think I have maybe an in there. We'll try to get them to change that.
Sorry,
point of view.
I didn't mean to.
No, that's terrible.
I was quite piffed with their support query. Yeah. It was quite
well. Maybe you got some. Maybe somebody had a bad day and it just
maybe.
Yeah. I bet you. I'm gonna make a promise to you that they're gonna fix that.
Let me see
now, this doesn't have anything to do with DNS security, which is another issue entirely, right?
No, DNSSEC is quite different. I think DNSSEC will likely never get traction. So DNS security is where we actually encrypt the client and the server, actually encrypt the sessions between them using a form of public key cryptography. I suspect that we'll see DNS over HTTPS before DNSSEC ever gets traction. So the idea of using DNS over UDP and having its own protocol will probably fade away. In fact, I actually use a thing on my iPhone. I use an app which lets me use DNS over HTTPS.
Quad ones. I love it. 1.1.1.1. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And this actually stops when you're at a cafe or something like that, people can't intercept your DNS queries and use those for data and analytics. And I'm a bit privacy freaky myself, so that scratches my personal itch.
In some cases, my DNS is, in fact, leolaporte.com, I think, does not go through Hover, goes through Fastmail, my email provider. So I think maybe Fastmail needs to work on this too. In their defense, in both Hover's defense and Fastmail's defense, it's not that it doesn't work, it's just not fully compliant. So that needs to be fixed. Is there going to be a flag day for full compliance?
It'll just be a rot thing. So over time, if the root servers stop responding to legacy queries, then eventually things just stop working, and that's the only way we can move forward. They've been agonizing over it for some years, and they've basically realized that there are things we have to do with DNS to move forward, and we have to get to the point where we say, right. And they've been carefully, this is all explained. If you go to the blog post, there's all the data is there pointing you to source material, explaining the whole thing in detail. So we can just, check your domains. If you want to understand more, hit the blog post, go to dnsflagday.net. There's lots of information, and take some time to learn about it if that's the thing that you need to know.
Hover's primary business is as a registrar. So what I don't know if I'll move off of Hover. I'll just move my DNS somewhere else, right?
Yeah, that's what the chat room is saying too, right? You could also, because a number of people in the chat room have said that they've actually had great experiences with
Hover. They're a great registrar.
I've never used them.
Yeah.
But they said, yes, they keep their DNS, other places.
And as I said, Fastmail, which also can do DNS, and so some of my of my domains are DNS, including leolaporte.com, for mail reasons, I think, are hosted at Hover. And they also show up as a problem. So I think, let me try some other ones. Oh, that's an interesting issue.
Yeah. And it's not an apocalypse. So, don't, but it is something that
it would be
eventually
if you were on such an old server that it didn't support at least some of these extensions, right?
Yep. If people want a recommendation, I can recommend Cloudflare. They are actually charging you
exactly
what it costs.
They started doing domain service, yeah. Can everybody, I think you have to be a customer now. They're not yet open to the public, are they? I think you have to be a customer.
No. I'm checking here now and it's yes.
Okay. When they first announced their domain name service, they said it's going to be for, now, by the way, you can be a customer for free. Okay, good. So now you don't even have to have a Cloudflare account to yeah, it says early access. We'll be rolling out access to Cloudflare Registrar on stages based on factors like how long you've been a Cloudflare customer. So it is not going to be available. This will be eventually a publicly available.
It's super cheap too. They're charging you the wholesale cost.
Right.
So I'm looking at my etherealmind.com domain. What a chance to plug the hell out of that, hey? It's $7.85.
That's great.
That's half the price of Hover.
Yeah, domains are cheap at because they don't do anything else, I guess.
Well, it's just a script.
Speaking of bad guys, GoDaddy has had a little bit of a slap in the face. GoDaddy's poorly designed security. You're going to have to explain this. I think, Greg, you could explain this to me. Allowed spammers to use well-known domains registered on GoDaddy to put out, like, that is sextortion spam. Did you get that one where you got an email saying, I know your password, it's, and by the way, I've recorded you on a porn site, you might want to send me money, or I'm going to give this to all your friends. That's the one.
I got those twice in the last month.
Yeah, and by the way, it scared me because it was a password I had used many years ago.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Oh, yeah.
So that's due to a flaw in GoDaddy, and Brian Krebs discovered this one.
I think the takeaway here is, based on the evidence of the last 5 to 10 years, you shouldn't be doing business with GoDaddy. They're a bunch of hopeless losers. I mean, we've just seen them do everything wrong consistently, repeatedly, over and over and over. At this point, why are they still in business? Are people stupid?
Yeah. In fact, this flaw, this vulnerability, was first written about in 2016 by Matthew Bryant.
Mm-hmm.
And it basically allows somebody who has a GoDaddy account on the same domain name server as a big company to send email out from that big company's IP address, thereby bypassing a lot of spam filters, which look at IP addresses to see who they should block.
Bad stuff.
Bad stuff. So I don't know if GoDaddy's fixed that, but that is it first came to light because somebody mailed a bomb threat from virtualfirefox.com, which is a Mozilla Foundation domain.
Yeah, I just would strongly recommend that people do not ever use GoDaddy. They are proven to be the least reputable internet provider probably of any great size. And, you know, we've had so many stories with them over the years. Why are we still doing this?
Confirmation that Dr. He Jiankui did, in fact, China has confirmed, use CRISPR to gene edit babies. Those babies were born, and China says he forged ethical review papers, recruited 8 couples to participate in his experiment, resulting in 2 pregnancies. One of the mothers gave birth to twins nicknamed Lulu and Nana. These are the first, as far as we know, humans born with their genes CRISPR edited. He had removed a gene that supposedly would give these children better resistance to HIV and other diseases, smallpox, I think. But the problem with CRISPR gene editing is the side effects are unknown. And while people have done this in the lab to rats and other things, this is the first time we know of this. And this was a big story. When we talked about this, it was unclear whether it had really happened. But now that we know it's really happened, I think this is a watershed moment.
Yeah, you know, CRISPR is likely to be one of the biggest breakthrough technologies of this century. When we get to the end of the century and we look back, like it is likely to be, you know, one of the big ones. Moving too fast in this area is fraught with all kinds of risks and dangers that it just doesn't feel like we should be, you know, moving that quickly, right? There should be a lot more research. There should be a lot more things done in labs before, we put this in human beings. So that's the scary part. And that's why I think the scientific world is really cringing and has been cringing about this. And why they haven't supported, obviously, the work.
Every nation has laws against this. I mean, this is, everybody agrees, this is not the time to start doing this. Although, once the genie's out of the bottle.
Well, don't you think, not to be too cynical about it, but part of it is, like, some of the articles that I've read, like, people are suggesting that, you know, this guy kind of did this on his own, was going to promote himself, and so, not to be overly cynical, but, like, if China was the first to make some sort of CRISPR breakthrough, I feel like that they would have gotten behind it and, like, look at how Chinese technology and medicine is a. So I'm wondering if the problem here is that this guy was sort of a lone wolf that trying to be a little too promotional, because if he wasn't and there was real legitimate breakthroughs, I don't feel like China would be throwing him under the bus like this.
Yeah. I'm not sure. You know, he's disappeared from sight.
I think there's two things here that we aren't considering. One is that the current research indicates that the use of the CRISPR technology is actually incredibly damaging to the genes themselves. So not only are you using CRISPR to target specific genes, but what's coming out is the evidence is that CRISPR is actually damaging entire gene structures.
Right.
So you may actually be causing more genetic defects than you're actually fixing. And So this is the reverse side of a breakthrough. The reality starts to set in that there might be some downsides.
The children are not being identified by the Chinese government, but they said the Chinese government says we are going to monitor them because there is some concern about their long-term health.
Well, there's a great
remember
deal of
when Dolly the sheep was the first cloned animal. These clone sheep died very quickly because it turned out not only were they cloning the sheep, they were cloning their biological clock.
So the senescence was actually cloned at the same time.
Yeah.
I think I think the challenge here with the CRISPR stuff is they're actually attacking the germline. So what that means, if those children have genetic defects, they'll carry through into the children of those babies. And so they replicate down through the years. And we don't want a situation perhaps where uncontrolled use of CRISPR that is actually damaging to the germline then gets fed into the gene pool. That is theoretically the end of the world type scenario.
Yeah.
So science wants to be careful about this.
On the other hand, if any country is going to do it, you'd think it'd be the first would be the Chinese. I guess that was your point, Jason, right? Is that, you know. There's so many issues. I mean, it's not even the side effects. Not even, let's say you could do it effectively without side effects. Then that raises a whole slew of other problems. Will it only be available to those who can afford it? Will billionaires become a new species because they can afford to have children that are smarter, faster, better, more good looking than everybody else?
It's amazing how much, you know, science fiction, of course, has been dealing with these issues for so long, right? Like, I remember in Deep Space Nine, in Star Trek Deep Space Nine, where remember the doctor? It came out like about halfway through the series that he was genetically manipulated. He was kind of an underperformer, and he had this, you know, genetic manipulation and turned him into kind of like this brainiac. And then of course, you know, Jurassic Park, it was like, you know, the whole, you're so busy trying to figure out if you could, that you didn't stop to think if you should. And which of course that was all about, you know, gene manipulation and dinosaurs.
On the other hand, I mean, if you could do it, I mean, if these kids were successfully CRISPR edited to be resistant to diseases, that's a good thing, right?
Oh, I mean, the potential of this is amazing. Yeah. I don't think anybody would argue with the fact that being able to, get rid of diseases, be able to protect against diseases, be able to do all kinds of things that are, mind blowing, really. The potential is fantastic, but moving too fast in something like this is fraught with so much risk and so much error.
I don't know if there's any speed with which you can move because we just don't have mechanisms to even think about this or to. I mean, I'm not talking about the legitimate issues that you raised, Greg, of whether it works and whether it causes problems, but the ethical issues in just modifying genes. We don't have any mechanism for this.
It's far
Congress
too early.
Can't even
it's
figure like, out whether we should build a wall. Forget it. I mean, this seems so beyond our capabilities and our understanding.
And like we have autonomous cars on the road and the risk of, you know, coincidental death or accidental death exists. But imagine if you could put an autonomous car on the road that would run now for the next 500 years and you couldn't take it off. That's
history
the
hat,
sort of
Leo.
Thing that...
You know, huh? History hat.
History hat.
Do you want to know the only reason that atomic energy was able to be regulated by the U.S. government was because when they developed the bomb, it was during wartime, and so the president had special wartime powers too. So the whole fact that the entire – like atomic energy is an entire industry, but it's entirely regulated and controlled by the U.S. government because it was during wartime and the president had wartime powers to make that happen.
Had it been developed by private industry – be a completely different issue. Yeah.
Wouldn't have
probably not. Actually, I agree with you, Theo. I think you're right, but if it wasn't at that point in time, all of the governments of the world united to agree that nuclear power had to be controlled because of the risk. So
they only did
I used
that
to work
the
for
here's the difference. Here's the difference. It's still very hard, as Kim Jong-un will tell you, to create an atomic bomb. It takes a lot of skill, a lot of expertise, and a lot of tests. It turns out CRISPR is something you could pretty much do in your basement. It's not that hard.
Yes.
And that's the real problem here is that this technology, whether it was developed by a government or private labs or whatever, it will get out. And unlike an atomic bomb, like that, lots though. Of people. Yeah, there is a lot of technology like that, isn't there?
Yeah. But we've got the same problem with cocaine and heroin. People doing that at home, and look at the damage that that's caused.
Yeah, look how easy it is to make meth.
CRISPR will be a thing. I'm confident CRISPR will be a thing
in our lifetime. I think. Yeah.
Oh yes, 100%. And ultimately, it has great potential to make things better. It's just, you know, humans and humanity is mature enough
not ready
to
for this.
Actually deal with this in time, but the time is certainly not there yet. We're so not such ready early days.
You know, one of the I've mentioned this several times. I'm reading. I love Yuval Noah Harari, the philosopher from Israel, who wrote Sapiens and Homo Deus. His newest is 21 Lessons for the 21st Century. And one of the things he's pointing out is as we're doing this kind of regression to nationalism, and it's happening in many countries worldwide, this kind of nostalgic desire to close in. It's happening in Britain, as you know, Greg, and it's happening in the United States. The problem with that is many of the problems that we have to deal with in the future are not national but global. You can't deal with climate change nationally. You can't deal with CRISPR nationally. It's going to take a global effort. And in many cases, countries are moving in the wrong direction. A country can't ban CRISPR and then expect it not to be used everywhere else. Right? In fact, nuclear weapons is a global issue, not a national issue. And the attempt to deal with it nationally is fraught with peril, as we well know. If they've got them, we have to have them.
It's a global world, and you can't turn back the clock on it. Yeah. And the things that are happening, you know, they're ultimately going to be blips in the radar. You know, we know that this is the way that history moves, right? It's often two steps forward, one step back. And, you know, it's funny because one of the greatest examples of this is, you know, China and U.S. and their trade relations and all of that. We are so intertwined and interdependent, you know, on each other commercially that it's ridiculous. A lot of this thing is so much posturing and so much, you know, really negotiation tactics in many ways from both sides, because it would be catastrophic to both the U.S. and China to not have a really strong trade relationship.
Oh yeah,
and
we've got to.
That's just one example, right? Yeah. It's just example.
That promotes peace. I mean, that's as
it does.
One of the reasons we haven't had a nuclear war is because it would be catastrophic for both sides, and everybody knows that, right?
Sorry, guys. Guns of August. Guns of August. Guns of August.
You're talking about World War One.
Yes.
I know that.
They said that there would never be a global war. Oh no, it's impossible. Our trade relations. They thought in 1914 that they had a global world where trade was so intertwined.
Interesting.
And there's no way we would ever go to war.
Yeah, interesting.
It's true. Actually, January 18th, just passed. You know, 9 days ago, was the 100th anniversary of the Paris Treaty to officially end. World War One. So I've been reading about this. So what I'm not saying it's impossible that there won't be, that humans aren't possible of going down that road again. I'm just saying every day we are more interdependent.
Yeah. The best hope for it is globalism and global trade. That's the best hope for peace. It may not be sufficient.
Yes.
But we know nationalism is the wrong direction.
Let's just point out the people who will be leading those decisions. We've got President Trump. We've got the Chinese leader for life,
Jin Xiaoping. President
Xi, he's now been appointed for life.
Yeah.
So he no longer has to face up to elections. So he now has absolute power over that particular part of the portfolio. Look at the collapse of Venezuela and Brazil. So now South America is in a great deal of trouble.
You're just going to depress us if you keep going, Greg. Can you stop?
Yeah. You know, look at what's happening in Africa. I mean, there's various things happening in Africa which are quite concerning. The European Union is struggling to hold up its momentum around change because the members of the European Union are very weary of the change and the whole purpose of the EU was for peace, right? To stop another war from happening by unifying the states into one. So it's entirely realistic that we are looking at preconditions for for you know, a return to war.
But I think we can also say this: the difference between the Guns of August and its sequel, the Guns of 1939, the difference is we have nuclear weapons now, and I think there's no question a global war would be disastrous in a way that World War One and Two weren't, as bad as they were. Yes.
I mean, even Putin said that recently, right? Like, even Putin said,
everybody
like,
understands
this is getting stupid, and we're going to have a nuclear war if we don't do it. Like, this is the, you know, essentially, you know, leader for life of Russia.
Yeah.
Not in the same way as Kim Jong, as
President
China.
Xi. But, Kim Jong, yeah.
As President
Xi. Hey, Leo,
Xi,
exactly, you got something but, sunny?
yeah, no kidding, huh? This is depressing. Ay, ay, ay. How about the Amazon Scout, a small autonomous six-wheeled delivery robot that's about to take over Snohomish County? These are cute. This is coming. Let me show you the video because it's a really cute little video. I wonder, though, when I look at this, if this is the world we live in. This is a little bot that's driving down the sidewalk. Watch out, Grandma. Here comes the Amazon delivery bot. Fortunately,
there's been some of these. Sorry, go ahead, Leo.
It's moving slowly, but I still makes me a little nervous. This clearly, by the way, is the Desperate Housewives neighborhood, a phony neighborhood in Hollywood. And then, look, she comes out. I don't know how she knew, but the little bot was out there waiting. Its lid comes open. She gets her package. It closes the lid very slowly. Watch for pinching, and then moves on. Is this? I understand why Amazon wants to do this and is promoting this. But is this at all viable?
So, it's, Leo,
actually, there's that.
Okay, wait a minute. One at a time. Let's start with Brian. We'll go left to right. Yeah, Brian, go ahead.
I'm apologizing for plugging my pod, but this was the episode we released literally today.
Good.
I talked to Christopher Mims of the Wall Street Journal about this, about this exact thing. And the concept being that you're more likely to get a burrito delivered to you for lunch from an autonomous vehicle than you are to commute to work in an autonomous vehicle in the next 5 years. You're going to get stuff delivered to you by AVs sooner than
but
you
less you less likely about. Cars, more likely these little babies.
Yes, exactly. And so then this is what we talked about. There's a whole ecosystem of startups that are doing these little things. Although also Waymo and everyone else it's sort of everyone's, you know, playing both sides of the fence in case one thing takes off over the other. But so the concept is there's a couple things. And one of them was super surprising to me. Like you're mentioning, like that's the Desperate Housewives neighborhood, because I'm thinking I'm here in Dumbo and Brooklyn, and I'm like, well, listen, everyone's going to kick those things off the sidewalk here in New York, whatever. Okay, but listen,
you can't even charge your Tesla anymore because people cut the cords, they park their trucks in the Tesla charging slots. We don't like these things.
This is the thing that surprised me. Is I don't have it in front of me, but in the article he talks about the statistics point out that in suburban areas,
yeah,
the most underutilized resource in terms of land are sidewalks.
Yeah, I know.
And so that if you have
no one walks anymore.
Right, there's that. But then
empty.
Also, so then think of what Amazon is also doing is Whole Foods and these sort of go stores or whatever. So what if 10 years from now, Amazon has, you know, your gas station just essentially becomes, or your corner market or whatever, becomes this quasi way station for these tiny bots that go out and make the deliveries. And not even that. It doesn't even have to be just that. You could think of what FedEx and UPS does. You know, FedEx goes to a certain, like they have to go and the guy runs out and delivers the package, whatever. No, the FedEx truck could go to a certain location that the algorithms
opt. It'd be like a Merv. For
it would be like 30
packages.
Different children going out. Yeah, exactly.
George Mason University just took delivery on 25 food delivery robots. They're going to deliver pizza and...
And that was the other thing. College campuses and retirement communities would be the first most obvious use for this.
Yeah.
So I actually, the funny thing is there's one of these that's been in use for, I believe since 2017. It's called Robbie.io. I had a kung fu fight with one at CES last year. Sort of a funny, there's a funny picture of, in my Instagram, of me sort of joking around. Like I was, you know, I'm going to sort of kick one that was going around. CES. And so the cool thing is they it looks the new one, that was the Robbie 1.0.
These look like the Robbies. I wonder if they're the same technology.
Yeah. Exactly. So I don't know, maybe Robbie's doing it for them or something.
They're little six-wheeled. It looks like an Igloo cooler on wheels, basically.
Well, they all look like everything that's in the Death Star that's running into people's ankles in Star Wars.
That's true. Exactly right. I think one of the questions was like, what happens if just a couple of people come, you have one of these running around at night and a couple thieves come and they're like, hey, let's just pick this thing up, throw it in the back of our van, see what kind of packages are in there. I guess there's like on the Amazon one, there's some kind of alarm that will go off if you try to pick it up or something. So it's pretty interesting to think about. But clearly this is happening already. The Robbie, like I said, it was developed by these MIT scientists. It's been in use in the Bay Area for at least, I think, the last at least almost 2 years now.
It's fascinating how science fiction completely informs us. It's not that they were right, they predicted it. It's that the people today who are developing this crap all watched this. Here's the Star Wars clip on the Death Star, the little Robbie the robot. And, of course, Chewie goes, and it runs away. Who doesn't remember that? Right? That's exactly what they invented.
Awesome. There's no way I'm going to be a Dora Downer on this because I think it's the dumbest thing ever. Nice PR stunt though. Realistically, if you put these in suburbia, the distances in American suburbs are so large. There's no way these things are going to have the battery life.
It's moving pretty slow. It would take like days to get across town.
Your average American,
your burrito will be cold.
American suburbs, everybody's on a quarter of an acre. You're talking 5 kilometers, 20 kilometers.
You're just mocking our McMansions.
Yeah, so your burrito by the time it gets to you isn't going to be in a fit state to eat.
Well, that's why it makes sense to do it in a college, I guess, right?
And then what happens when you start to get 5 to 10% loss around these things? What happens when they just trip over on the footpath or the conditions of the footpath
change? I think people
change?
Are going to beat them up. I honestly do.
People
in Arizona shoot at the Waymo vehicles. I mean, I think they're just going to beat the hell out of them.
Yeah, there'll be some of that, but. Whether that reaches critical mass or not, or who knows. But my point is that the footpath can change, and then all of a sudden it breaks down. So then they have to send somebody out to retrieve it and redo the pattern because
there's a couple other things that
most of America, you guys don't even pay enough taxes to put gutters on roads, much less have pavements.
There's a couple other things that Chris said that pointed out that because they are slower, it's cheaper to do the research and development because unlike cars, like if you keep it under 20 miles an hour, if you keep it up, so. The reason that I'm saying, and we can make a wager on here right now, if Leo gets a burrito before he commutes to do Twit.
Yeah. Which would get there first?
But the thing is that Leo lives a kilometer from his
office.
He's going to win because he lives right on top of a food court, right? He can walk down for dinner and be back.
They're probably specialized environments, especially university campuses, where these would make a lot of sense.
Specialized environments. So let's not conflate a limited use case in a highly controlled environment.
What is Snohomish, Washington like? I mean, why are they testing it there? Besides the fact that it's near Amazon headquarters, is Jeff Bezos live there? Is he waiting for his burrito?
It's super suburban, looking like Desperate Housewives neighborhood.
But Greg has a good point. For instance, in Petaluma. For a long time, they didn't require developments put in sidewalks. So even just outside of Twit, there are plenty of places where you'd be walking on the street, where Robbie would be going out in the street because there's no sidewalk.
And it can't be on the street because it'd have to be a registered vehicle.
And I know that because when I bicycle, the bicycle path will frequently just stop.
Lots of bike lanes here in New York. You can't have a vehicle on a bike lane that goes over 20 miles an hour.
There you go.
I'd say a one in ten chance of success as a widespread. In terms of a limited use case.
I was trying to bring up a cheerful little Robbie the robot subject.
These people in Silicon Valley are all stupid. They got more money than sense.
Well, we've definitely settled that question. let's take a little break. More with our panel. They're wild today. They're on fuego. Our show today brought to you quite literally by CashFly. When you download our podcasts, you are downloading it from our content distribution network, from CashFly. And man, it is the best. I just love it. We've been using CashFly for, I think, 10 years. Every month, several petabytes of data are delivered to our listeners, our viewers, via CashFly, audio and video both. I never get calls at 3 in the morning. The CDN's down. I don't have any problems. I've never had a problem with CashFly. CashFly delivers rich media content up to 10 times faster than traditional delivery methods because it has a server near your customer. And they're even faster than other major CDNs, up to 30% faster. And because they have so many servers, they can give you a 100% SLA. CashFly guarantees the best experience for all your customers, no matter where they are, no matter what device they're on. We couldn't be happier with CashFly. We're not alone, though. Thousands of others trust CashFly's reliable network, including LG, Microsoft, Adobe, Ars Technica. Petabytes of data. I'm telling you, it is... I love it. I love you, CashFly. Say goodbye to logging in several times a week just to make sure you haven't gone over your limits or even daily trying to track your CDN usage. Because when you call your CashFly representative, you'll set up a custom plan tailored to your usage, your needs, based on yearly usage trends. So you don't have to worry about those spikes. Most of us have spiky demand, but CashFly handles it. In fact, on average, customers who switch to CashFly save more than 20%. 20%. Just for you, CashFly is offering you a complimentary detail analysis, no hard sell, of your current CDN bill and usage trends. Just see what you could save. twit.cashfly.com. twit.cashfly.com. We love them, and I know you will too. twit.cashfly.com. I don't think this is going to calm anybody's blood here, but the first GDPR fines for Google are come in, €50 million euros. France and CNIL, which is the French regulator, says that according to CNIL, Google is in breach of two provisions of the GDPR. First, by not making its data collection policies more easily accessible. Second, by not obtaining specific user consent. They want... CNIL wants you to say yes to each of Google's services each time, including YouTube, Google Maps, and more. Mm. And the 50 million euros is just the beginning.
This was mainly with onboarding on a new Android phone. So yes. Like the setup process, yeah.
Just, you know, think about how many times when you go to a website, you have to click now to say, yes, I know you use cookies. Okay, that's all right. Now, put that on your Android device because that's what they're saying. They're not saying that that information isn't there, that you're not giving permission. They just want it to be more granular. They want you more, you know better, make it more public. I'm not sure I'm against that. Google says they announced late last week that they will appeal.
Yeah, and there's a sequence of follow-ons from here. Germany's coming up with various...
Oh, it's just the beginning, kids. Yep.
Yeah, it's just the beginning. Yep. We're seeing other court cases come up right the way around the European Union. There's some going on here in the UK as well. I think one of the things that we're seeing here is sort of a general reaction to the move fast and break things. So if you go out and you break someone's business and then they start fighting back, you shouldn't be surprised and go, oh, I was just having some fun. I was just trying some things out. But, you know, and then the person on the other side says, look at this. You broke my arm. You are at, I'm going to come after you, right?
Right.
So the motto of move fast and break things actually causes damage. And when people fight back, you shouldn't be surprised and go, oh, but I did nice things.
But what
for
damage?
You.
What damage are you talking about? Yeah, you're talking about the like shopping. The shopping
so from
decision.
The French point of view. No, I'm talking about the French. In the French culture, they're very passionate about defending the French language, the French media, the French way of life. And they very many people in France see Google as destroying their unique francophone lifestyle.
Oh Lord, well good.
And so this is an absolute cultural
reaction. If I were Google, I would say fine, have fun. Go enjoy your croissants, read Le Monde, smoke your cigars, and
yes.
We'll
Google
see
can't
you
do
later.
That because
I know they
it's
can.
A platform. If it can't, if it's
they
not,
they can't because the internet
not.
Is a global platform. It's international. You can't pick and choose. Yeah.
And everyone, you know, everybody's tweets that day were like, oh, 50 million euros, that's nothing to Google, which it isn't. Like, you know, like the FTC fines, the record FTC fines, if Facebook or Google, if Facebook was rumored to be facing the FTC's considering fining them, but the record FTC fine was only $22 million. You can only do what the law does, but what the law allows you to do. But the difference in Europe, as he was saying, like it's a death of 1,000 cuts.
Right.
First, it's France.
And it could at some point be more money because it could be up to 4% of your global revenue, which for Google would be billions.
Well, and that's if they don't rectify things to the EU's satisfaction. Yes.
So in the UK, the Cambridge Analytica fine on Facebook was $2.5 million or a few million dollars. It's like petty cash down the back of the sofa. But there is legislation now moving through the government to turn it into billions.
How about this one?
How about foldable phones?
Not yet. I want to keep your blood pressure a little higher for a little longer.
All right.
And then we'll get to foldable phones because they are on the way. Thank you for trying, Jason. I really appreciate it. But I do have one more Google story, which is the Dutch surgeon who was formerly disciplined for medical negligence has won a legal action to have Google remove search results about her case. So her registration on the Register of Healthcare Professionals was suspended by a disciplinary panel. After appeal, it was changed to a conditional suspension. She is currently practicing as a result. But she says, when you search for my name, you find this, a website which contains an unofficial blacklist which mentions this. She says it's a digital pillory, and she wants that removed. The Dutch data privacy watchdog agreed. Initially, they said no. So she went to court, and the court said no. The surgeon has an interest in not indicating that every time somebody enters her name on a search engine that she appears on this blacklist of doctors appears. Google's claim that most people would have difficulty finding the relevant information on the medical board's big register where records are publicly held. The court didn't agree. What do you think? The right to be forgotten.
The kicker's in the final paragraph. It basically said that it's not up to Google to make the decision about whether or not this happens. It's a society's decision. And
that's
in
fair.
Particular, it's the medical board. So if you go to the last paragraph, you'll see the kicker.
Yeah.
And that's the point. The point here is that Google's become the judge and executioner by putting this data online.
That's a very loaded way to put it. Google didn't put the data online. The data is online from somebody else. Google's merely a search index showing what's on the web.
If she loses a lawsuit 30 years ago and there's 30 different newspaper articles about her malfeasance or something, alleged, you know, I don't know this lady, but you couldn't, who would think it would be fair to go to every library and rip all those newspapers out of the library?
So you're saying that Google's response, so the thing to do is to edit the search results as opposed to bring down this blacklist site, for instance.
Yeah. So the point is that the medical board found
BS.
Her to be – the initial case said that she was negligent. The medical board later ruled that she wasn't, but she's still listed on the site.
Then,
she can't get
the site.
Then go to
the site.
She can't.
Why?
It's outside the jurisdiction.
Well, sorry, lady, but this Google's job is not to make up for an inability.
No, I absolutely
there's good reasons
not.
Why you can't
no,
go and
not.
Pull that site down. It's in a different country. Why
no,
should they go to Google?
You can't treat algorithms as if they're extrajudicial or outside of politics or outside of society.
That's not what they're saying. That's not what they're saying. They're saying,
they are saying
you have to modify
to
the – no, you're wrong. They're saying that the algorithm has to be responsible as opposed to merely reflecting what's on the internet.
Absolutely.
That's the not algorithm. What you want. The minute you do that, then every nation in the world comes to Google and says, well, we want it to reflect our point of view, our point of view,
absolutely.
Our point of view.
And that's exactly what should happen.
It's untenable.
Algorithms are people.
Oh,
you
you're
cannot,
completely nuts.
If a company can
you're
be a person.
You're completely nuts, Greg.
The people
that's
at
nuts.
The company make the algorithms. The algorithms are people and have to be treated as people. They have to be culpable and legally liable for anything that they do. And that's the only way we're going to move forward, because that's how in medical science, when they do an operation, they test it, they validate it, it goes through a very long development process, and then it's gradually released to make sure that it delivers the results you expect. And now we've got these jumped up young kids in Silicon Valley releasing algorithms that have these massive societal impacts, and then
what
going,
you want to go back
fault?
To the Middle Ages.
It wasn't my fault, it's just the algorithm.
want to go back to the Middle Ages. What good is the internet if without a search engine that accurately reflects
it? If I had a car and it rolled down the street and smashed into five vehicles causing damage and ran over a family of five, who's liable?
That's a completely inept analogy. It has nothing to do with it.
No, it's not. It's the same. It's an algorithm just runs down the road and smashes in the car and runs over people. It's the same thing.
In fact, I think you can make a strong argument. Google should be required to accurately reflect the internet. Otherwise, it's editorializing.
Because then you're going into libraries and ripping out the newspapers. Like a newspaper only ever had to issue a retraction. They didn't have to go and find every erroneous copy of their newspaper and burn it to the ground.
Remove it. Yeah.
It's insane. If you start piecemealing search engines, you're never going to have a search engine. What you're asking for, Greg, is insane. It's not even doable.
It is doable.
Well, it's not Google scalable. It's completely unscalable.
They take all the porn out. They take all the child abuse out.
I would make the argument.
That they feel like, funnily enough, their algorithms can do it on YouTube.
Big
and
mistake.
Do it
they should have never done that. I agree that Google opened, unfortunately, a can of worms when they started doing that. They shouldn't editorialize at all. They should attempt to make their algorithm accurately reflect what's on the internet.
Snapchat and Twitter are all media companies. They choose what they publish. Now, just because it isn't a person,
that's where they made the mistake. They should never have done that.
The algorithm is a person, and it publishes, and it must be responsible and liable for the decisions it makes.
So what you're saying is that what we're going to have is a search engine that editorializes constantly.
And that's what it already does.
Well, I don't think it already does, and I think you're pushing it in the other direction. It does some of it, which they should not have done. But now you're saying they should do more of it, which is absolutely insane.
Have to hold these companies liable for the decisions of its algorithm, because people made the company is a legal person. The algorithms were created by people. The algorithms act like people. They work with people. The algorithms are people. And the companies who produce these algorithms have to take responsibility for them and the outcomes that they produce.
What do you
they
have,
must be
Greg,
scale,
in a world? Scale, go ahead.
Ill of human knowledge, though, is just way too – it's not even conceivable to do it. I mean, there are a few things where they've tried and many would argue have failed and where they do try to do it. And they try to do it in countries like Iran and China. And, you know, some would argue that they're successful. But look at the ramifications of that. It is the societal ramifications of those things are significant, and they stifle, human creativity. They stifle innovation. And it's barely possible, even in those countries, right, to keep it from happening.
It's not Google's job to take down the dictatorship in Iran. That's your job.
So in that case, you think Google should go ahead with its censored search engine in China?
Yeah, absolutely. China is China. The politics in China, you have to respect the government of any country in the same way that I have to respect President Trump as the leader of the U.S. nation, and he represents you, like it or not. And in the same case, at any other country in the world, it is not for Google.
Would you
or Facebook.
Say it's Google's job to remove this mention of the French surgeon from just the French search results, or should they do it from all search results globally?
They just won that case recently, by the way.
I know. I'm just asking what Greg thinks.
Yeah, I think
so
they should.
Wrong.
If the source has proven that something's wrong, then it should be taken down everywhere.
Everywhere.
Because the information is now false. Right?
Now,
and provably
you, but you
false.
Just put Google out of business, and in doing so, destroyed the public internet.
But the public internet is only a reflection. Like, the only reason the papers issued a retraction was because it was physically impossible to go and retract every newspaper and bring it back, right?
It's not physically impossible to do
what
you ask.
It's not that we don't want
But the end
that.
Result is
want.
That you have a bowdlerized internet, which is a bunch of holes, and the only thing that exists on this so-called search engine is stuff that's approved by every nation in the world. What would that be?
It would be back to where we were before the internet came along.
That's what you want?
Why not?
Okay, so we're done with Greg.
Why not, right? So why not?
That's called reductio ad absurdum. You don't want an internet.
We would still have advanced search engines, content available on demand.
No, we wouldn't.
But there would be
We wouldn't have any of that. We would go back to before the internet, you just said.
We would go back to the idea of content before the internet, where each country saw its own view, right? And that's not entirely
Greg, you just talked. You just painted yourself into a completely untenable corner. You understand
it's gonna
that,
happen.
Right?
It's going to happen. The EU GDPR has already started that process.
That's a
right?
terrible thing. And it's why I believe Google was right to get out of China. And if Google has to get out of Europe, then they should.
to do that, then the solution would be the algorithms again, because how are you going to ever do a different internet for every country and every polity in the world? You'd have to rely on the algorithms.
I think we should go back to Yahoo, a human curated directory. Right.
These companies have to be liable for these algorithms. They can't walk up and say,
now, I agree with you
wasn't
there.
Me, it was the algorithm. Right?
Let's take a time out, and then we're going to talk about foldable phones. Actually, I still want to talk about Facebook's plan. According to the New York Times, this hasn't been confirmed by Facebook, to integrate WhatsApp, Instagram, and Messenger. And Mark Zuckerberg's editorial in the Wall Street Journal saying, hands off. We're okay. We're good. We're the good guys. But first, let's take a little trip down memory lane. It's been an amazing week this week on Twit, and we've got a video to demonstrate that.
Previously on Twit.
Oh my God! Oh! I don't think snakes yawn. I think they measure.
Oh, I saw it.
Yeah, but I think she was measuring. She's like, can I get his head in my mouth?
Windows Weekly.
Windows 10 Mobile will no longer be supported, the operating system for Windows Phone, as of December 10th of this year. This date's been known for a while. Microsoft updated a support page and actually said on it, Microsoft is recommending users go to Android or iOS. This is kind of the final word, guys. They're giving you explicit written instructions. Don't wait around. Go to iOS or Android.
All about Android.
The Motorola Razr might be poised to make a comeback, but with a price tag of, and I hope you'll sit down, $1,500. And now, a newly discovered patent that was filed on December 17th shows that the design could be a foldable screen inside with a second screen on the outside. I gotta say, there's nothing better than hanging up on someone with a flip phone.
Oh, yeah.
That is completely gone. And now you just go, and you just tap your screen. And it's that's not the same.
Twit. Now, where'd I put my Android?
The snake changed the page to being homeless is better than working for Amazon.
Oh, snakes are capacitive. Look at that.
Snake is capacitive.
Oh.
That's really interesting. Are you trying to make a political statement, Snake, about homelessness and Amazon? Wow. That was a very woke snake. Our show today, brought to you by Eero, my Wi-Fi router. I love it. I think we all know that the old days of a single router somewhere in the living room talking to the whole house, those days long gone. We're all using too many internet devices. We're all consuming too much content. You've got the kids watching YouTube in the bedroom, mom and dad watching Netflix in the living room. You've got Aunt Sally in the kitchen. She's trying to download recipes. It's crazy. That's why you need an Eero enterprise-grade Wi-Fi system in your home in just a few minutes. You download the Eero app on your iOS or Android device. It walks you through the process. You set up the base station, and then you add the beacons, and the app will help you place them. The beacons just plug into the wall. What I love about the Eero app is I can see how my network's doing. I can see how it's doing right now from here. I can see what devices are on it. I can pause individual devices, or I can even say, all of these devices that belong to our teenager, it's after 10 at night. Let's turn those off. I use Eero Plus, too, which filters all the bad stuff out, captures malware before it gets onto the computer. State-of-the-art WPA2 protection. Eero's already announced they'll be going to WPA3, and they say they can do it in software, which is awesome. That's why it's so cool to have an Eero, because an Eero is upgraded constantly. It gets better all the time. It's always secure. You don't have to remember to update it. It updates automatically. Not only do you have the latest features, you have the latest security at all times. And I have to say, when I first got the Eero, I had some questions, and I called them up, and they were great. They stayed on the line with me until I got the port forwarding work and all the stuff. Eero's Eero Plus is actually the thing that put me over the top. So we've had the Eeros for a while. In fact, I got the new Eero system when they came out and sent my old system. I set it up for my mom. She's loving her Eeros. Eero Plus is a simple, reliable security layer that defends your home devices against malware, spyware, phishing attacks, and, of course, unsuitable content. That's why Michael is not seeing anything adult, because it's filtered off. The combination of Eero and Eero Plus gives you complete protection for your network, your devices, for the people who use them. Eero Plus offers the ability to block malicious and unwanted content across the entire network. I do that. I have that turned on. By checking the sites you visit against a database of millions of known threats, Eero Plus prevents you from accidentally visiting malicious sites without slowing anything down. It automatically tags sites that contain violent, illegal, or adult content. You choose what your kids can and cannot visit right in the Eero app. I see everything. I know everything from the Eero app, how much bandwidth each device uses. That's fascinating. I could do port forwarding. I could do reservations. I just think Eero is great. And man, no more dead spots, no more buffering. It really works. Never think about Wi-Fi again. You'll get $100. This is a great deal. $100 off the base unit two beacons package. That's the starting point. Plus a year of Eero Plus by visiting Eero.com/twit. Eero.com/twit for $100 off the base package plus a year of Eero Plus. Eero.com/twit. Eero.com/twit. And don't forget to check out with the offer code TWIT to get that special offer. I know you've been suffering with your Wi-Fi. Suffer no longer with Eero.
This mesh is like the rest.
Mesh with us. This is that story about the Razer phone. That would explain a $1,500 price tag if it had a foldable. This is not the phone they'd be talking about. This is the old Razer, which everybody had. I'm sure all you guys had these. I think it's kind of an interesting idea. So let's talk about foldable phones. There's one already available. They were at CES, the Royal.
Yep.
Did you see that at CES?
Yeah, and CNET just published an article today called Foldable Phones Are Real. Here's Everyone We Know About, which is a great look at everything that's there and coming. The Royal FlexPay is the first one. On the list. And then, of course, you know, Samsung Galaxy, Huawei this week, Xiaomi this week.
Yeah, too. We saw the Xiaomi CEO in a Twitter. Now, he said that was a concept phone, but that was a triptych, a trifold phone that the two wings folded back. Boy, that's wild. There it is. There's the video.
Yeah. I mean, I love the concept on this.
Do you want this? Like, do you think this is a good thing?
No, this is partly why I wanted to talk about it. I'm not saying it's a bad thing, but I'm still trying to wrap my head around why I'd want it and not really why I'd want the ones that are probably going to come out in 2018, because those I don't think many of us really want. Because
I worry that they're going to be janky. Exactly. How many times can you bend that screen before it starts showing wear on the hinge, right?
It's also really thick, and, you know, although we've liked bigger phones, it's sort of the bigger phone thing has been a little weird and counterintuitive over the past few years. I think thicker is not something people want, you know, that just try to stick in your pocket, something like that is not very practical.
Now,
but when thinner.
Yeah, when Samsung showed its foldable phone in the kind of the sneak peek, and of course, we're going to find out more on February 20th when they have their event. It looked pretty thick, but he said, oh, this is in a special case. So it's hard to say. If thicker is not going to solve anything.
No, but if I had a phone the size of my phablet today, and then somehow it also could kind of like the Xiaomi prototype piece, if somehow it could, you know, the screen could essentially double itself. When I was ready to sit down and read something or do some work or do some bigger typing or whatever, I mean, there've been an insatiable appetite for big screen phones, right? Because they are more productive. You can do more things with them once you have more screen. And so this is like the phablet run amok. This whole idea of the folding phone is really an extension of the phablet phenomenon. And I'm just trying to wonder. And this is why I'm sort of throwing it out to you all of like, what does that give me? Just assuming we get to that world where today's, you know, phablet, you know, this one or this one can double its screen size. How compelling is that?
It's obviously doubling the screen size when you need it or want it, right? And it almost goes back to the argument of iPod versus cell phone, so why not make them both the same? So why have a tablet and a smartphone? That's the most obvious thing. But you know what? Here's the reality. Forget about what we would maybe have a use for it is. the reason these are coming is because no one's been able to differentiate a phone for at least five years now.
Right.
They all look exactly identical. And so guess what? I bet people are going to have a reasonable amount of success because people are going to be like, you know what? Look at me. I have the one phone in my friend circle that looks different than all y'all's phones.
Why don't they make a triangular phone?
Fashion aspect. Yeah.
And I think that's very important, not necessarily in the U.S., but in some cultures, phones are status items. And if you've got a unique item, that actually is part of a cultural status thing where you want to be able to show off that you've got that. I believe that to be the case in certain parts of China and other places in Asia.
So maybe it'll just sell as a status object as opposed to something useful.
That's right. It might be something that only lasts for 6 to 12 months before you move on to something else, you know, fashion type item. And Apple's been trying to sell phones as fashion accessories for some time.
It's kind of the size of my paper planner, right?
Yeah.
It's, I think so. And it opens up and look, it's foldable. I got a big screen.
And the second part is that for some people, smartphones are their computers and indeed a television and a book.
Right.
And if you want something that does all of those things, then perhaps there's a trade-off there. So this is a case of, I think, testing the market to see if the idea can catch on. And if it does, they can then iterate around it. So
I'm going to make a prediction. We're not going to see a single foldable phone at next year's CES, not one. It's going to be like 3D TV. It's just going to disappear without a trace, maybe a few bubbles. That's it. Go ahead, Brian.
There's been a lot of wagers going on here, so yeah. I don't know, Leo. I don't know that I like that one at all.
You like it? You want a foldable? Who here wants a foldable phone?
I don't.
No.
Have you seen those articles, though, about how in the Indian cell phone market I can't remember, but the amount of hours that they spend on video, the point that Greg just made about how if it's your entertainment devices, if this is how you are consuming all of your entertainment and your media, so that then it fits in your pocket and you do your daily business. And then at night, I'm not saying it replaces your TV, but you maybe live in a country where you don't have a big screen TV or whatever. Like, so why wouldn't you want to unfold this thing and have a bigger screen? There's a lot of reasons.
What happens if your house is just a room?
Right.
Right.
Right. Mm-hmm. So if you're
in Japan, before smartphones, even they've had, because that's a big issue in Japan, larger phones that did a lot more. Right. Am I wrong on that? That was a very popular pre-smartphone product in Japan.
I think it's also to do with the use of emojis and the characters. Instead of using letters like we do, they Western use pictograms.
Yeah.
So the larger screens, as I understand it, and please, I don't want to pretend that I'm an expert here, but from what I've researched and read is that they tend to go for the larger screens because it makes more sense for the local conditions.
Yeah. Look at these images of cell phones from Japan and you'll get some idea. They all have, you know, kind of extra display capabilities.
Those were the ones that for years we would see and everyone was trying to sell us on mobile computing. And
nobody
and all
wanted
of us
them.
Were like, yeah. We're like, we don't want that.
Right. Yeah.
The OQO.
But that's because we were entering data with T19.
Right. The OQO. I remember that too. Yeah.
And today you can do it a lot more with voice. You know, some people are turning to voice as an alternative to the keyboards. And a lot of people have gotten better with the alphanumerics, like the touch sensitive screens make more sense. So I think there is some transition there. There's no innovation as such, just a transition as we do make marginal improvements on them.
This is 2009. These phones were.
Leo, this could be phones. Innovation, is what I'm saying. Like I'm with you in the sense that like it's probably unreliable right now or whatever. But like, are you saying that it wouldn't be innovation to have different screen sizes depending on when you needed it and your use case?
Let me think about that. There's some conditions. Obviously, it can't be thick. So if it's not much bigger, if it's something like an existing phone,
if we can get there, if we can
unfolds,
get there, no one's saying
I grant you that. So. The first generation probably be wanky. And this is based on AMOLED screens that can reliably bend and unbend without damage and showing, you know, wear of any kind. Okay.
But there's some
I don't see myself opening it up, to be honest with you. I feel like a Galaxy Note 9 or the iPhone XS Max, that's fine. That gets the job done. Maybe I'm just not open-minded enough.
That's kind of so there's also ergonomic issues with them too, or right. not. I don't know if ergonomic is the right way to say it, but you know how
usability with these tablets, issues. Yeah,
usability. Thank you. You know those tablets where you flip them over, and when you have to hold them and you feel the keys on the back, yeah, I hate that.
I hate that too.
I hate that.
I have a Yoga. I have a Lenovo Yoga, and I never do that for that reason.
I can't either. I can't stand, you know, any ergonomics that you end up doing that. Right. And I feel like that's my worry with these foldable phones. If this thing folded over and then, okay, I'm always holding it where I've got the screen is on the back, but it's not on unless I flip it over. It's like, I'm not going to like that. I know because of the ways that these tablets, you know, do that.
I'm going to stand by my prediction that this is exact. You're exactly right. This is an industry that's desperate for something new and different, some differentiator, and so they're going to throw a lot of spaghetti against the wall. This is a noodle that's going to flop back down to the floor.
Maybe they've spent so much money developing foldable screens, they're desperate to find a place.
That's
to recover
part of
that
it,
money.
Right? Do you remember the curved screen? Did you see any curved screens at CES? I have a curved screen Samsung at home. It's dopey.
You have to sit in the exact middle of it, right?
All it succeeds in doing is making the reflections from the window go farther.
Yeah, there's some curved screen monitors, like computer monitors, because you're always sitting in the middle of those.
That makes sense.
It makes
perfect sense
there. Yep. Perfect sense. On a TV, it makes no sense at all. You're rarely sitting in the middle.
You guys have CES PTSD.
That may be. I did not go this year, but I was told there were no curved screens. There weren't any curved TVs. Yeah.
That's right.
That was a good example of a differentiator that didn't take off.
Mm. But yeah, but TVs, I mean, you know, like you said, 3D TVs, all that stuff. TVs are a different kettle of fish. And by the way, I'm not sold on this at all, and I don't want you to think that I'm arguing for this because I want one so desperately bad. But I can see that
there might
be
some potential here. Yeah.
Maybe it's just because I'm tired of seeing the same old dumb stuff for 5 years that I kind of want something new to happen in the smartphone space.
Actually, that's one of our stories, is that we've reached peak phone.
Sure.
And that it's all going to get weird now as everybody desperately tries to find something.
48 megapixels this week. That just came out, right?
Have phones become too boring? Well, they're about to get weird. I think, honestly, the phone's going to stay the way it is, and that wearables, and it's not around the corner. It's going to be 5 years off, but wearables are the future.
Well, and Internet of Things, right? The Internet of Things is going to take a lot of these things that are in the phone today and move it off of the phone to other parts of the ecosystem.
Does 5G change this? The fact that another thing that may or may not happen. What do you think, Greg? Is 5G going to happen next year?
No, it's going to start. It'll be a slow, gradual rollout, probably 5 to 15 years.
What?
Depending on where you are in the world.
That long? Yeah.
Oh, yes. They haven't even finished the 5G standards yet.
I'll be dead
by then.
So
you won't see any purchase.
Leo.
And I mean, and in terms of what 5G delivers.
Well, I mean, actuarially, I probably will be. I'm just saying.
And really, the only thing 5G is going to give you is more bandwidth.
So But now, don't dismiss
lower
that.
Lower latency, more things
more
on the
bandwidth.
Network. It's going to give you,
Yeah, it does can change
it
things.
Won't,
you didn't have, no. until high-speed internet was widely available in homes, you didn't have Netflix. You didn't have any of this, right? It does change things.
Yes. Bandwidth has – the key thing that people miss about bandwidth is it has two key scientific properties. One is volume, how much you can fit down the pipe.
Right.
And the second one is speed.
Right.
So, yes, greater bandwidth not only lets you put more down the pipe, it also lets you put the traffic down the pipe faster, right? So, yes. You do get improved speed, latency. You also get more capacity. So whenever you talk about bandwidth, two-vector argument, not a single
point.
Vector argument.
That's a
which
good
is
point. Make we all often think
I don't
it
know.
One
I mean,
thing.
In Europe, 4G was so mean to you guys in Europe. I think that maybe you're underestimating 5G a
little
bit.
He's bitter.
Yeah.
Well, one, a couple of
I do
old
– think.
Go ahead.
So 5G, there are many things about 5G that the telcos want to have. They want to be able to take the idea of bandwidth and sell it as services and create more revenue for themselves or find a way to differentiate themselves. They don't want to become electricity companies. So a lot of what you read about this is telcos going, oh, if we could do this, we could build a service that charges more money. If we could do that, we could do that, you know, or we could – And I think just like 4G, we saw
what
all the same things that they're doing now.
Quibi.
Yeah.
Short form.
Yeah.
Sorry, I just went to the next story.
That's okay.
What is Quibi?
That ultimately the real factor in the consumer market is just going to be more bandwidth in more places at about the same price as we pay for it today. And there are some possibilities that we might see some differentiation elsewhere.
Self-driving vehicles.
And lower latency too.
5G.
Lower latency.
Yep. Lower latency is important for if you're driving a car and cars are communicating
Video
with one
games.
Another. And
They won't do any of those things. Cars have to be autonomous. They can't communicate with each other.
They can't communicate with each other. One of the chief benefits of autonomous vehicles.
But if they start to communicate with each other, you can't guarantee that you're going to get data from the neighboring car, so you can't rely on that. What if the neighboring car is not compatible with your standard or it's faulty in some way?
But isn't that what 5G is promising, right? That's what I've been sold.
That is absolutely a load of bunk. There's not one autonomous car maker that cares about 5G. Only the 5G people care about autonomous cars because they think they can sell them a premium enhanced service, and none of the car makers are talking to the 5G people about using that service.
I mean, it's not bunk. It's just one of those visions that has a lot of steps that have to be dealt with before the reality is there. But, combination of edge computing.
A lot of people talk about the end of traffic congestion because you have cars that communicate with one another. You get to a four-way stop. The cars know which one should go first. You're saying a car needs to be a standalone, an island. But I think there is a lot to be said for cars that can communicate with one another, right? What's your intent? We have to infer what the intent of the guy ahead of us and the guy behind us is. But a car could theoretically query other vehicles, right?
So one of the biggest things that happened at CES, and very quietly, was Qualcomm has this technology called Vehicle to Everything. It's C2VX. It is a standard that combines vehicle-to-vehicle and vehicle-to-infrastructure technology. Ford came on stage and said, we're going to put this across our entire range of vehicles in 2022, which means if Ford does it, the others are going to follow and do the same. So this enables literally vehicles to see around corners, right? There are 1.3 million auto deaths globally every year still, which, you know, when we look back a long time from now, it's going to be pretty horrifying to
terrible.
Us.
Terrible. Right? Yeah.
That we lived with this every year. So this technology, the vehicles can talk to the roads, the vehicles can talk to buildings, the vehicles can talk to other vehicles. They can talk to lights. They can talk to stop signs. They can talk to all of it. So, literally you can see around a corner, you're about to go through a light or a stop sign, a light that's green. Somebody else has a red light coming, but you can't see them because of the building. And they're about to run that red light, and then they're going to T-bone you. And, you know, those side impact accidents are the ones that are most fatal. Right. Well, with the road, communicating with you, with the building communicating, perhaps even the other car communicating, that is what enables that car to then stop and not get hit by that vehicle.
Well, and isn't that kind of in a way the promise of IoT in general is as computing moves to the edge, communication is going to be vital. The ability for all of these smart entities in our life to communicate rapidly and effectively with one another. I agree with you, Greg. We've got to get a standard, but it looks like this is
there's a lot of work. I'm not belittling what Greg's saying because there's a lot of work that needs to be done before any of these things happen. But I do think that the possibility is not pie in the sky or something that's not possible.
And there are, as you point out, very significant benefits. 1.3 million deaths.
So let me give you a hypothetical. You're in regional Australia. You're 500 kilometers from the nearest town. What's 5G going to do for you?
Well, if you're in the Amazon jungle too, but given the fact that the
you're
vast majority
the
of urban
network suddenly and the 5G
you can bring up
suddenly.
Those kinds of goofy counterexamples, but the majority of Earth's populations live in big urban centers where there's real value.
There's places where there's
but
no
you're
electricity.
You're not
going to
use 5G for that. Right. You're going to use local Wi-Fi or local communication systems. Yeah. They're going to be a microcell, and it's not going to belong. It's going to belong to the local traffic company or the local traffic agency or the town or whoever operates the traffic lights. It's not going to be part of the 5G network. Why would I pay a telco to run this? I can just do it in my traffic light with an antenna on top.
Sure. I mean, and the future networks are likely a combination of, you know, 5G is going to cover a lot more places with a lot better bandwidth, you know, much more cheaply. But, you know, some part of the future, too, is going to be combinations of still things like white spaces and, you know, other types of technology where we still have a lot of work to do on some of this last mile.
All of these things that they're talking about in 5G, we had with 4G. They were going to talk about small cells. They were going to talk about mobile base stations and blah, blah, blah. And none of them turned up. So, and there's no reason to think that anything changed this time around.
I wouldn't say none of them changed. I think, the 3G to 4G bump was, you know, 3 to 5x speed bump that was meaningful, that led to new businesses that nobody ever anticipated before, you know, that jump happened. And, you know, with 4G to 5G, we're talking a 10x to 100x bump. And so that's going to enable all kinds of things.
I've already agreed with you that bandwidth gives us better speed and better volume and better latency, right? Because bandwidth is a function of speed and capacity. But the point is that other people are trying to sell us network slicing or value-added services around small cells or localized cells. Now, that's going to give you greater coverage inside of a building and increase the bandwidth. But the only thing it all does is increases the bandwidth. It doesn't suddenly give the radio waves magical powers to read your mind or something like that. It's
Greg,
just
Greg, one thing I will agree with you 100% on is I cannot imagine how much we've had to suffer because the telcos refuse. They rage against this idea that they're just dumb pipes.
Yeah, they don't want
to
be a pipe.
How long do we have to suffer before they learn that lesson?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, hopefully, as long as you guys stop boosting 5G, then that'll be where they go.
Oh, it's our fault. Oh, you blame us,
do you?
Stop
pretending 5G is anything but electricity, because that's what it is.
Zuckerberg, according to the Friday New York Times, it's interesting how they give the credit to Zuckerberg. Zuckerberg plans to integrate WhatsApp, Instagram, and Facebook Messenger.
I thought that was super interesting too.
Yeah, why don't they say Facebook?
Yeah. Weird.
Anyway, this is Mike Isaac, who's well sourced, a San Francisco writer for the New York Times.
You know why that's weird, Leo?
Why?
Because remember, the whole idea is this year, all of these founders left Facebook, Instagram, WhatsApp founders. And we always read that it was because there were clashes
with Zuck
and they didn't want their products integrated in this way. Right. They didn't want to join the Borg. And so either that's a leak from someone that's going after Zuck.
Oh, you're right.
Or
you're so
smart. That is Zuck is, you know what? I'm going to own
charge.
This.
I'm in charge here.
Exactly.
Yeah. The move has the potential to redefine how billions of people use the apps to connect with one another while strengthening Facebook's grip on users, writes Mike, raising antitrust, privacy, and security questions. It also, this is the key sentence, underscores how Mr. Zuckerberg is imposing his authority over units he once vowed to leave alone.
Part of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm.
This is probably powerful point, but the antitrust is the big one. I think Zuckerberg is moving so that he can't be broken up.
Well, one member of Congress tweeted, this is exactly why we should have paid closer attention to the WhatsApp and Instagram acquisitions, because in fact, that's exactly what's going to happen is this consolidation and Facebook's going to be totally dominant.
There's no way Facebook could do an acquisition in the next 18 months, a major one.
I disagree because I think it's a climate. Happen. I think we're in a climate now where if you're going to do it now.
The
U.S. government has other fish to fry, so to speak.
But what would they buy? What's worth buying?
Anything that's a threat.
What, nothing Snapchat?
Nothing at this point. Maybe they're big enough Snapchat? They don't need to.
Yeah, pretty much. I think too much that they could buy. I mean, they could go and buy what's left of Yahoo from Verizon.
If something comes along that poses a threat, if something's got a large user base, that's what they've done, basically. Each of these services has billions of users if you combine them. And by the way, this is not confirmed by Facebook. This is Mike's reporting. But if that happens, you have a behemoth now of users.
But remember, this
is good for users. I would be thrilled if I could use WhatsApp to talk to Facebook Messenger and use Instagram to talk to WhatsApp. That's a good thing. We need to be clear.
They're not combining the apps.
No.
They're combining the infrastructure. Right.
Talk to each other.
Yeah.
And, by the way, another good thing for end users, Zuck, according to this article, is going to insist on end-to-end encryption for all three. That's a good thing. Yeah, and that in face of Australia and others who say you can't do it.
But he's also – so what you're saying there is you've got to remember too that Facebook Messenger has end-to-end encryption, but it's not safe or private encryption. It's just end-to-end encryption.
Yeah, Facebook still has access to the keys, right? As does WhatsApp. Yes.
Yeah, but WhatsApp is actually end-to-end so that
they're
Facebook
using
can't
Signal.
Get into the mess.
So Facebook doesn't have WhatsApp keys?
No, okay. Can't get into the data of WhatsApp. So that's why they can't monetize it and put ads against it. So the fear is it's not that Facebook Messenger will come up to a better level of encryption. It's more likely they're going to take the WhatsApp and take it down to Facebook. And that also solves a few things because the give to the governments might be, oh, Mr. Government, we're merging them together. Please don't antitrust us
better,
and break us
a
up.
A better view inside the content.
Yeah.
We will give you legal intercept, legal and lawful intercept.
Sure. Yeah. There you go.
And if they did that, then the governments are going to be like, ooh. But as I was talking to my daughters about this today, and they just went like, we just stopped using WhatsApp and Instagram and find something else.
Yeah, I think that this is a step toward them trying to bring them together, clearly. And the number one reason behind it is likely because Facebook – it is just dead in the water with people under 30. WhatsApp and Instagram are not.
Right.
But Facebook to all of those users, they're allergic to Facebook, right? Facebook is the network that my parents and my uncles and aunts and grandmas on. Right. And so they don't want to be there. I think to the point that I think if you do that, the users will flee and go somewhere else. And that's what, Facebook as a brand is essentially already a ticking time bomb because young users.
Which is why the time bomb, not just with its younger users, but also with government regulation, which is why Mark Zuckerberg wrote this Wall Street Journal opinion piece, The Facts About Facebook. The facts. You're so wrong.
Did you see Kara Swish's version of this?
No. What'd she say?
Let me look it up.
We need your information for operation and security, but you control whether we use it for advertising. People consistently tell us, writes Mark, that if they're going to see ads, they want them to be relevant. That means we need to understand their interests. And, we don't sell that to anybody because, that's how we make money. We have a strong incentive to protect people's information from being accessed by anyone else. They don't do a very good job of it, but we have a strong incentive of it. What do you think? This is obviously aimed at both governmental regulators in the U.S. and in Europe.
Right, because number one, he's not gonna publish this in the New York Times because he hates the New York Times now. But number two, everyone at Davos is more likely to read it in the Wall Street Journal.
Ah, Davos.
And then,
that's a good point.
So then, this ties into what we were just talking about is because if he sees regulation coming and he's working the refs. And then you can do the old Microsoft thing of like, well, a year from now, if you try to have me break off Instagram or whatever, like as we're saying, they're all one code base. We can't do that. They're completely integral. But here's the other thing, and I'm going to totally quote the person that turned me on to this. Sarah Friar said that, remember, Zuck still likes the real identity part of social media.
Which I do too, be honest with you.
And but also if you're selling ads against someone's real identity,
it's a lot easier. Yeah.
So
Twitter doesn't know who the hell you are. Right.
So, okay. Number one, this solves a lot of problems, right? So number one, governments were being nice and blah, blah, blah. And also by the time you actually bring the hammer down on us, our code base is unified and Also, it's easier for advertisers. They don't have to spend on several different platforms. It's one platform. But then that's the bottom line, is that he's chopping off, as we know, he bought the threats to his business. Okay.
Yep.
But it's still not the pure business. So if Facebook, as was just being said, is not where the kids are at or where the growth is at or whatever, the problem that they still needed to solve was they had created their well-oiled business model, but these other arms of the business were not in that perfect business model. So boom, chop that off, and now you're going to be integrated into the sort of, you know, slicing and dicing, selling ads against every interest and thought that you ever had in your head that Facebook has done. So it doesn't matter if everyone leaves Facebook, because boom, they're going to fix that.
Yeah, well, if you're going to leave Facebook, you have to leave WhatsApp and Instagram too, or you haven't left Facebook at all.
Yeah.
What I learned when I deactivated my Facebook account is it doesn't deactivate Facebook Messenger.
Right, it's completely independent.
Completely independent.
Yeah, I think I read the whole article and I just saw somebody who's going like, what I've been doing is working really well, and just because you don't like it, you can just go and suck it up. And
it was quite the opposite. He was saying, really, this is the best for all of us. You just don't understand if you think there's anything wrong with what we're doing.
That's why he wants to do that Oprah show. Remember, that's his this year's resolution, is that he's going to have TED Talks or whatever.
He's going to talk to everybody. He's not going to listen, but he's going to try.
If you only understood what I want, you'd agree. I'm just misunderstood.
Harris Wisher did a great job of taking it down. I put it into the show notes if you want to have a look at it.
I'll find it, yeah.
It's right at the bottom of the Facebook section, but it's just tremendous. She's basically saying, you know, you're an idiot. Stop being childish, because it does read, the whole article reads incredibly childish. It's
says, Mark Zuckerberg, let me fix that op-ed you wrote. I can tell the people what it is you're really trying to say. Oh, boy.
read that. I think ultimately what's happening here is that they've decided to bunker up. They're pulling back. Now, the flip side of it here is, and I'll put a prediction out here, is how long is it before Facebook domiciles itself in Singapore or Indonesia just to get away from the U.S. government and being harassed all the time? So if I'm going to be harassed by the U.S. government and it's going to try and regulate me and
– Well, that hasn't even started yet, though, by the way.
Kara, by the way – okay, first paragraph, when I started Facebook, I wasn't trying to build a global company. I just wanted to bring people together. Kara says, this is what he's really saying. We're old now. We big now. It came from my one really good idea. AOL sucked and I could do better, and I did. Now the noise has reached me up on Billionaire Mountain, so I'm going to have to pretend I care. No rich person is going to pay too much for this muffler social media service, and poor people aren't going to pay us at all because they apparently don't have any money. So everyone will have to endure the ads we shovel out and stop griping, because free ain't free, people. People consistently tell me if they're going to see ads, they want them to be relevant. Kara says, we have a lot of data, a lot, so much, especially about Spanish gardeners, which is, by the way, for some reason, Mark brings up people who like pages about gardening and live in Spain as one of the categories. The internet also, Mark writes, allows us far greater transparency and control over what ads you see than TV, radio, or print. Kara says, sure, we give you tools to control the ads you see, but they're akin to the instructions you got to program your VCR back in the day. Thus, the modern-day version of a blinking light you never fix. She's got a takedown, all right, and a good one.
I mean, to be honest with you, when is somebody going to put an adult in charge of Zuckerberg so that he can't write this stuff and get away with it? I mean, it's just so badly done out of touch.
Who is the adult? I mean, Sheryl Sandberg? Who's the adult?
But she's obviously lost control of him. She's given up and backing out of the whole thing, I think. She just can't take the pressure, and she knows she's going to get burned, so maybe she's pulling back.
So Mark wrote, for us, technology has always been about putting power in the hands of as many people as possible. If you believe in a world where everyone gets an opportunity to use their voice and an equal chance to be heard, where anyone can start a business from scratch, then it's important to build technology that serves everyone. That's the world we're building for every day, and our business model makes it possible. Kara says, the real power is in the hands of one person, which would be me. I am founder. I am chief executive. I control 60% of the stock that matters. I control the board. So stop complaining, especially you Spanish gardeners. The end. You're right. I didn't read that. That's a good, must have been in today's paper. That's a good takedown.
Yeah, she's doing a great job. And as she says, yes, let's not forget that for all our criticism of Facebook, let's remember that Facebook has been a force for good and a force for things. And just because it's failing in US and in Europe because it's losing touch with what people really want, it's also absolutely huge in other parts of the world.
People need it.
South America, yeah, Africa.
And people rely on it. I agree.
Asia, yeah.
It's not an easy answer.
So just remember, one of the things I want to say to people who are watching is don't get bunkered just because you're a European or you're a U.S. citizen. Start thinking globally instead of regionally. And just because you don't like it in terms of the context that you live in the U.S. or in Europe doesn't mean it's not huge somewhere else. So be aware of that. Be sensitive to that.
Kara also points out that Mark's kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place. If he doesn't say anything, people get upset.
Yeah.
And if he says anything, people get upset. So there's nothing.
But he's kind of he's earned that opprobrium.
Yeah,
well, he's earned that opprobrium. Oh, you know, he's consistently messed this up year in year out.
Yeah.
You know, based on the evidence, every time he does something, he messes up.
Right.
He needs, you know, it's time to put somebody else in charge of the business so that the company can sincerely embrace some change, because he just seems to keep doing the same thing over and over and thinking, well, if I'm just going to do it again until they get it, because I know best. I'm going to take you all with, you know, tell you what you need to know.
Let's take a little break.
Those telling
and then
words.
We will wrap things up with our great panel joining us from Tech Meme's Ride Home podcast, Brian McCullough. His new book about the history of the internet is a must read and available everywhere. Is there an Audible version of how the internet happened?
Not read by me, thank God.
All right. Well, look for that, because I know I like to listen. How the Internet Happened, from Netscape to the iPhone. It's great to have you, Brian. Jason Heiner, Editor-in-Chief of Tech Republic. Always a pleasure to have you, Jason. You're one of my heroes. Do a great job there and at CBS Interactive. And Greg Farrell. No, you are. You got me elected president of the internet, and for that I'm eternally. You're kind of like my Steve Bannon. Only shaved or something. I don't know.
Oh my goodness.
And Greg Farrell.
I do read my audiobook, by the way. Sorry.
Yes, and do a very good job, I might add.
Oh, thank you.
And Greg Farrell is also here from the Packet Pushers Network, a great podcast network for people who love the network, packetpushers.net, at Ethereal Mind on the Twitter. Our show today brought to you by Wasabi, hot cloud storage. Being able to efficiently and affordably store data, and man, data is crazy these days. There's an estimated 163 zettabytes of data by 2025. Being able to store that data efficiently and affordably is critical for businesses. Companies need to store it in the cloud, but of course there's concerns. Wasabi addresses these concerns because it has disruptive technology that's turning the industry on its ear. This revolutionary process lays data on disk sequentially as opposed to in blocks. That means their storage, Wasabi storage, is 80% cheaper and 6 times faster than Amazon S3. It's incredibly simple. There's just one tier of service. And some of the things you get, things like unlimited free egress, no charge for API calls, and one of my favorite features, immutable storage. These are things I love. Immutable storage means you can say, hey, that stuff I just put there, that can't be changed. No malware can change it. No fumble-fingered employee can delete it. That's immutable. 11 nines data durability and up to 6 times faster than AWS. What? It's just as secure and, in fact, in most cases, more secure than your on-prem storage. HIPAA-compliant, FINRA-compliant, CJIS-compliant. And if you do have a ton of data to migrate, get the Wasabi ball. You just put it on the ball, send it to Wasabi. You can migrate petabytes of data simply, quickly, and securely. Look, I understand this is a new name and a new company. You don't know them. I just want you to put them on that list. If you're shopping for cloud storage and you got the big three on there, and I know you do, just add one more. And I'll tell you what. The boss might really be thrilled when you say, hey, boss, 80% cheaper and 6 times faster. You could try it right now, free for 30 days. If you go to the website, you'll see it's a terabyte of data, but if you use the offer code TWIT, it's unlimited. There's no limit. Store it all up there. See how it works. See how fast it is. Wasabi.com. If you're a business and you need to put your stuff in the cloud, you need to do it fast, affordably, You got to check them out. WASABI, wasabi.com. 6 times faster than S3. 1/5 the price. You're going to love it. Wasabi.com. Just add them to the list. Check it out. That's all we ask. Use the offer code TWIT for free unlimited storage for a month at Wasabi. Wasabi.com. Google is going to the Supreme Court. I think this is an important case, so I wanted to highlight it. You may remember they lost the Oracle suit over Java. It wasn't about using Java. It was about whether an API can be copyrighted, whether somebody can take, for instance, the Java API and duplicate it. Google petitioned the Supreme Court saying you've got to review this. Here's their argument. Unless the Supreme Court corrects these twin reversals, this case will end developers' traditional ability to freely use existing software interfaces, APIs, to build new generations of computer programs for consumers. Did I just mention Wasabi uses the S3 API? Yeah, Amazon probably doesn't like it, but an API is public. That's the whole point of an API, and that's good for everybody. Just like we all learn to use, Google writes, computer keyboard shortcuts, developers have learned to use the many standard interfaces. By the way, this is them explaining to justices that average 83 years old what an API is. Developers have learned to use the many standard interfaces associated with different programming languages. Letting these reversals stand would effectively lock developers into the platform of a single copyright holder, in this case Oracle, akin to saying that keyboard shortcuts can only work with one type of computer. Is that an apt description, Greg Farrow? And are they right?
I think so. I think in this case, Oracle's lawyers got one over Google's lawyers and managed to get away with it. Oracle, of course, was defending its Java and the control of the Java ecosystem at the time. Android was written in Java, and Oracle wanted to extract some money from Google. And Oracle knows how to play these games. They're incredibly smart about this and have really good lawyers. And in this case, I think that they got one over Google, and Google has to do this, I think, not just for itself, but for the internet at large. Because if they lose this, then they can't actually read my website and scan for search data.
Right. I remember we interviewed Jonathan Schwartz, the last CEO of Sun, on triangulation. You can go back and look at it. And he was talking about the day Sun was sold to Oracle. And at that time, Oracle acquired, of course, not only Sun's assets, but Java. And he said, I remember sitting in the room and the lawyers, the Oracle lawyers, the Oracle negotiators, they were rubbing their hands with glee because they knew they were acquiring technologies that they could make a lot of money on in court.
Yeah.
That was what they were excited about. They weren't excited about what Sun's technologies were. They were excited about the licenses. They were excited about the lawsuits.
And I wouldn't be surprised. They know how to make money. At the end of the day. Well, the trick here is that every website is fundamentally an API. When you request a HTTP request, you can make a case that pulling HTTP requests from a website is an API call. Yeah. And the original idea behind HTTP was heading in that direction. And if you can patent that and take control of the whole idea that an API is controllable, then in theory, large parts of the web suddenly stop working. And it would be very bad for change. I wouldn't call it innovation. Copying someone else's API is not an innovation. That's just copying somebody else's API and then putting your own technology underneath that API. We need that competitively. We don't want to have a monopoly. So we know, for example, Facebook is a monopoly of that particular space. It's very difficult for anybody to compete with Facebook because of the network effect. If we have APIs dominated, then competitors will find it very difficult to enter the space. And capitalism and competition, which is a part of a modern society, then gets stifled. And that's why I think it's important.
I think I overestimated the average age of the Supreme Court. I think it's actually, thanks to Brett Kavanaugh replacing Justice Roberts, somewhere around 64 now. So it's a little better than it was. But imagine the difficulty. It's bad enough explaining a lower court what an API is and why this is an issue, but imagine the difficulty in explaining to the Supreme Court what this all means.
You have to hope they have some smart clerks, right, that understand
that's a good point. I'm sure the clerks do.
Yeah.
We'll watch that. I think that's going to be an important case. I thank you for watching TWIT this week. What a show. Greg Farrow, Packet Pushers Network. You're on fire. You always do that. You always light a fire on us and make us think, which is important. That's important.
Yes.
It's important.
Strong opinions, loosely held. Change my mind.
That's his motto. Thank you, Greg. Always a pleasure. You stayed up late tonight, and we are very glad you did.
As always, a privilege to be with you.
Thank you. Jason Heiner from the beautiful Tech Republic in Louisville, Kentucky. I'll see you in May.
Excellent.
First day
I would
in
love
May.
That.
Oh, it'd be fun.
Let me know if you come.
I will. First mint juleps on me, but you could buy the mud pie. That Derby pie, that's good. That's
Derby
good
pie.
Stuff. I love my Derby pie. And it's good. Brian McCullough. He's the host of the Tech Meme Ride Home, our historian for the day. It was good to have a historian here.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I put on the history hat now and again.
I like that.
Necessary. Yeah.
I think that's really helpful, actually, because it's, and as I get older, I think it gets, I understand better the importance of context and all this stuff, because, we're like in the middle of it all. And,
no, but that's the point, Leo, is that if you live long enough, all the stuff you remember is history that you got to tell the youngins about.
Too bad I don't remember anything. Thank you. Great to have you, Brian. We do Twit every Sunday afternoon, 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern. That's 2300 UTC late at night for Greg Farrow. But you can always watch wherever you are. If you watch the live stream, it's at twit.tv/live. Actually, it's audio and video, so you can watch or listen. If you do that, join us in the chat room. That's where everybody else watching and listening live is, irc.twit.tv. There's always a great conversation going on there, and I appreciate the chat room. Thank you for being here. If you can't watch live, and I know most of you can't, hey, no problem. We've got on-demand audio and video. No blinking 12, no VCR to set. We will provide you with an on-demand version of this show absolutely free. All you have to do is go to twit.tv. All our shows are there. You can download an episode audio or video, and you can also get it in your favorite podcast application. So that makes it really easy. All you have to do is look for This Week in Tech. Say, I want to subscribe. You'll get it the minute it's done. One more favor I'd like to ask. It's time for our annual Twit survey. We try to make these simple and easy, but it's very helpful for us in understanding better what you like, what you want, how you listen. And look, we don't collect any information about you. We do not spy on you. The survey is the only way we have of kind of getting a better idea of who is there. Not required. But if you would help us out, I'd appreciate it. Go to twit.to, that's our URL shortener, /survey19. If you go to twit.tv, there's a link right there on the front page too. twit.to/survey19. We really appreciate your help in better understanding you. It helps us sell ads, but it also helps us understand what it is you need from us. So we thank you very much for helping us out there. Thank you for watching Twit. We'll see you next time. Meanwhile, another Twit is in the can. Bye-bye. Doing the Twit.